Welcome to the May 15, 2024 meeting of the Flavanna Board of Supervisors. Anybody that's alarmed by my face, I'm identifying as Freddy Krueger, but I had laser treatment and has me a little glowing. We will start with our Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll move to adoption of the agenda. Anybody make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we adopt the agenda.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. Goad. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Passes 3-0-0. All right, County Administrator's report.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the board, I got a few things to report this evening. So, want to welcome Ethan Nose to the Public Works Department. He is starting as the Assistant Equipment and Fleet Maintenance Technician. He started on May 6th. Kind of a pretty fresh off Louisiana graduate, so glad to have him on board. Scouts Trash the Trash Day was held Saturday, May 4th. So Scouts Trash the Trash Day is an international messengers of peace project for scouts around the world, where each scout is challenged to bring a friend or family member along and pick up at least 1 kilo of trash each on the first Saturday in May. So you can see the picture on the right there. We had Boy Scout Troop 154 and Cub Scout Pack 154, thanking them for picking up 30 pounds of trash on Saturday, May 4th at Pleasant Grove Park. Like I said, it's unfortunate that we see trash around as much as we do, but I'll certainly want to thank them for what they do. 2024, the May Carnival. The carnival was held Wednesday, May 8th through Saturday, May 11th. There was rain on Friday and Saturday, which kept some patrons from visiting the event. So Valley Amusements, they are the ones that run the carnival. They received 25% of ticket sales, and then the county receives 25%. Of all sales plus 100 per game that's played. The carnival net was 32,000 and the county net 11,009. And some of the expenses were for light towers, porta-johns, hand washing stations, and a dumpster. And we use a VA veterans group for parking Saturday night only. And so the county total after expenses was a little over $7,100 for that. And again, it was weather was nice, and besides a little rain we had, it all worked out really well. And kind of on Saturday, kind of in addition to that, on May 11th, we had our first of the season, Grooving at the Grove, was the kind of the first official Grooving at the Grove concert event. The Atkinsons were the musical performers, and they gave a great show despite of the rain for the first hour of the performance. Flavanna Youth Soccer Association sponsored and operated the beer garden for the event, and then Mobetta Ice was the food truck at the event. Flavanna County Library also hosted a fun zone for kids. We estimated, and unfortunately, you know, the rain started not long right after 5 o'clock. The event started at 5, so you can kind of see the big clouds from the lake, you know, from the lake area coming this way. So I think it held some people back. Specific to in the concert area, we had 128 patrons that were in attendance, and then many of them stayed throughout the rain and watched and listened to music. So it was a good time, and we hope to build on that. And the next event is Saturday, June 8th from 5 to 7 p.m., and we're going to probably start doing the food and beer garden at about 4 o'clock with the food trucks and stuff. The band will be JBB is the band, and they kind of do an eclectic, psychedelic, southern rock and roll jam band is what they do.
Wow. I got to hear that.
Yes. and then goat story time at the library. As you can see, they had 51 kids and adults come to see veterinarian Melinda McCall and her kids on Saturday, May 11th at the library for goat story time. You can see everyone snuggling with the baby goats there.
Again, I wish I was there.
Story time with Tom Brady.
That was a picture of you there. Your little goat there.
That's a little too much on top.
The goat.
And in some upcoming meetings, I want to point out for the public that we are going to be moving our meetings back to the Circuit Courthouse for the June 5th meeting. So that meeting, again, our meeting will be for June 5th. It's a 5 p.m. regular meeting. And we are also going to be holding the solar work session on June 5th at 7 p.m. This says Circuit Court, but I think we're going to probably move it to the Morris Room just because we've got some configuration limitations in the courtroom. So we'll probably do the solar work session in the Morris Room after the regular meeting. And then our meeting on June 20th, we don't have a meeting on June 19th because that's a holiday for Juneteenth. So that meeting will be held Thursday, June 20th at 6 p.m. again in the Circuit Court. And then for our first July meeting, Wednesday, July 3rd, it's a double meeting. So we have a 5 p.m. meeting and then just kind of our regular meeting for 6 p.m. So pretty much we'll have a 5 p.m. until whenever we end meeting on July 3rd, which will do any type of regular business plus any public hearings and stuff like that.
So was that the official announcement about moving back to the Circuit Court?
I will. Yes, I will say so, yes.
De facto.
Yes. Happy to answer any questions that the board has.
Well, I'll say, since it was brought up, I think we're all anxious to move back to the courthouse, and it's just more fitting as our county seat, I think, for us to have our meetings there. And I'm going to piggyback off the scout thing, because Saturday I did the board presented to Ryan Scopoletti, the Eagle Scout, recognition of it as an Eagle Scout. And the couple of these that I've been to now as a board member, I'm just reminded of that this group and these kids, what they're learning, and when we were scouts, we didn't have this in video games. We just went outside and played. And then these days, it's odd to see kids who do commit to being out and learning those lessons and serving the community. So just wanted to recognize them.
I'd be curious to know how the Boy Scouts organization here in Fluvanna compares to other ones, because it seems like we get a lot of Eagle Scouts. So they do an excellent job.
Well, this core group that's coming through right now has been, I remember those guys coming through the middle school, and I always loved, because they always would wear their hoodie. And if there was somebody that was doing something, and I was busy doing something else, hey, count them. They made sure that they do whatever they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, and then Mike has one coming up that he's presenting to in Fork Union, so to your point.
Yeah, they did a great job.
They're rolling in.
There's two coming up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mr. Oliphant is the one in Fork Union. Mr. Frazier is the one, and those guys were all, I'm trying to remember the troop number. They all had on troop 540 or something like that. Because they would always wear those sweatshirts.
Just one update, too, since we're kind of just announcing some things. We are going to hold the Planning Commission meetings in the Morris Room. We figured from just from a setup standpoint, and again, I think for probably 97% of all meetings, mostly the topics that we have, we don't have big enough crowds where we need more space than is in the Morris Room. Certainly, if there's something of we see that may be a big attendance draw, we'll have to adjust and maybe make it in, we could always put it into the courtroom depending on what's going on there, but we're going to try and have the Planning Commission meetings in the Morris Room on the same evening, so that, on the normal dates.
And you might have said this, but also in having the work sessions in the Morris Room when we have a board meeting, it keeps us from having to have a deputy on payroll when we're just going through a work session, so we can just transition back.
So when there's a work session, we'll hold that in the Morris Room and then go over to the courthouse?
So if there's a work session ahead of like a regular meeting, most likely, depending on what it is, we're going to have it in the Morris Room, and then we can go over to the courthouse if it's a later meeting. Vice versa, if it's a, you know, a 5 o'clock meeting, but maybe we have a 7 p.m. Work session, we can then move over to the Morris Room, which would then let the folks be able to close the courthouse down and things like that. And some things we may do too to kind of just, you know, monitor and keep the deputy time down is, you know, probably even doing closed sessions. If, let's say, if we have a closed session at the end of the meeting, probably go over to the Morris Room and do closed session in the Morris Room as well, too. So kind of getting back in the old groove of how it was before and just trying to iron out some of the kinks as we go. So
just a point of clarification. I think I recall seeing an email coming in from the planning department to the Planning Commission today. I don't think any of y'all would have seen it. I guess I got it as the board rep. But it indicated from what I saw that it was the work session, the solo work session was going to be in the courthouse. Is that going to be in the Morris Room?
We were planning on having that in the Morris Room, okay. Correct, yes. And so when everything goes out for the Planning Commission as far as official notification, we'll make sure that says the Morris Room so people are not confused on
it's
where it is.
It's 150 foot long.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we'll also close out the board meetings now before going into closed session, right? Since we're going to switch over.
We wouldn't close them out. There would be some special verbiage when we're going into closed session, basically saying that we would be adjourning the meeting from the Morris Room. If the closed session at the end of the meeting and we're at the courthouse, we would go over to the Morris Room for the closed session. But before we go over there, when Mr. O'Brien whomever is reading the closed session list, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, we would have something in the motion then that says we will be adjourning the meeting from the Morris Room.
Morris Room, yeah.
We just opened the door before the closed session.
We'll just change where we adjourn.
Correct, yeah.
And then also we have to have a deputy at the entrance, different than here, just because, of course, it's the courthouse.
Yep.
All right, thank you.
So happy to answer any other questions. Sorry, that's a lot and lots of moving parts on our end right now, but happy to be back in the courthouse.
Amen. All right, we'll open our first round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium, state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anybody wishing to?
Good evening. My name is James Schoenster. I live at 843 Jefferson, Palmyra. And at your April 17th meeting, the subject of a population study was again discussed by this board. As I was unable to be present for this meeting, I had to use the YouTube recording to watch later, and some of the conversation was unintelligible. So I'm looking for clarification on this topic, and perhaps the rest of the public would benefit from that as well. As such, I will present my understanding, and if it would please the board to make things more clear to the public afterwards, I invite that. However, I understand that nothing I say here is required to be addressed and respect this board's discretion on what does and doesn't qualify as new and or old business. So while conversation began on whether or not to add this item to the school board's budget or the county's, ultimately there was some agreement that it would be a collaborative project as it would yield benefits to both parties. Expectations for class size, demographic information important to our fire and rescue or law enforcement operations, and insight into infrastructure bottlenecks are among those benefits. My sentiment is the same as that of our superintendent. I'm rather shocked that this has not been done yet. What Dr. Gretz may not be in a position to say as bluntly as I may is how confounding it would be if this board has decided to make the schools ask for it during carryover, especially since they did exactly that last year and found no support from this board. I can forgive the two newest members if they overlook this lack of continuity, but the majority of you are still here. So I reiterate, it is past due. We spend hours during budget season agonizing over how to spread out necessary investment in our emergency services such that trucks and equipment do not all hit our budget at once. Yet the largest part of our budget has a glaring blind spot, potentially the size of an elementary school, and we keep telling them to wait. I hope I am mistaken, because also during this meeting, it was determined that a large sum would be budgeted under the BOS contingency fund, and another way to interpret what happened on April 17th was this board decided unofficially to earmark the $30,000 population study in that line item with head nods, And if that's the case, please make it a priority in this meeting during new or old business so that the process of getting this population study completed is delayed no longer than it has been so far. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. A simple request. The public notices that appear online on the Fluvanna Review, it would be nice if there was just a header for the date. There's some confusion between when a public notice is published, because of the word published. The owner editors of the Review say they publish it once a week, and yet the notices come up whenever they come up online. And it's only important because recently a couple of notices have required to respond within 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and there's no date. So I was confused, and so was Fluvanna Review. It's just a thought, just a header date when it shows up online. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
The speaker didn't give his name and address.
Oh, can you give your name and address?
Oh, I do apologize. My name is James Von Ochtnerder, and I live at 2126 Nahor Manor Road in Palmyra.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Anybody else? Seeing no one wishing to speak, we will close the first round of public comments. We'll move on to appointments.
Mr. Chair, I'll just bring up one slight change at the beginning of the meeting here. So it was noted that so per state code and county code, we should only have one board member on the ag forestal districts. Right now we have two. Mr. Hodge became an AFD appointee previously to being on the board, and Mr. Fairchild, you have been on the AFD as well. So currently we have two board members on there where we can only have one. Now, I had some discussions with both Mr. Hodge and Mr. Fairchild on kind of how we wanted to go about that, and I don't want to necessarily speak on it yet. It was discussed that Mr. Hodge would be interested in going into the governing body seat, and then Mr. Fairchild would step back from that position. And I just want to make sure that that is still the intention of both board members.
That's acceptable to me.
Absolutely.
Okay. So then I think with that, then, Mr. Whitten, I guess we would just need a motion to change the governing body appointee for the AFD from Mr. Hodge. I'm sorry, from Mr. Fairchild to Mr. Hodge.
Correct.
So made.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Now, with that being said, since Mr. Hodge was previously in the landowner position, now what that does, we have three landowner positions available for the AFD. And let me just make one point. There's this one slight difference. Because Mr. Hodge is coming off basically as of today, one term for a landowner position basically begins today, whereas the other two landowner positions begin as of July 1st, 2024. So those are the only changes. We have one additional landowner position to appoint, and just a couple little bits of clarification. As you see under landowner position or land use position, you have some duplicate names. If you are in land use, you can be either a land use position or you can be a landowner position. But if you're a landowner in the county and your property is not in land use, you can't be under the land use position. So as you see there, under the land owner position, we've got one incumbent seeking reappointment, and then you have three other individuals seeking appointment. And then under the two land use positions, you have two incumbents seeking reappointment, and then again you have two individuals as well seeking appointment.
Under landowner, would we now be looking for how many under?
You're looking for three for landowner, and again with the one thing, what I would probably say is, if the board chooses to elect an incumbent, you probably don't want to put that incumbent in as of the May 15th date, since they're already in that position. So just a point of clarification there.
I will say one thing. I'd like to nominate Ms. Morris to take Mr. Hodges' spot that would start today.
Yep, and
May 15th.
Yes, and we may have some individuals in the audience if you want anyone to come up and speak to the board.
And let them speak.
Yep. I see Ms. Morris. I will recognize Ms. Morris. I will let her go first.
I'm Susie Morris. I live at 6840 Thomas Jefferson Parkway, Palmyra, Virginia, at Quaint Lee Farm. I need to add a couple of things here that weren't on my original application. I was a member of the Rural Preservation Advisory Group, appointed to review the comp plan for 2040. In doing so, a number of questions and concerns arose as far as how to protect better the rural land and landscape. So as a result of attending meetings, talking with people in the various communities and going to various community meetings and the board meetings and planning meetings, I decided that I needed to write a minority report, which I did write in Turney in November of 2022. As an educator for 54 years, I've learned to listen, ask questions, seek answers, get input, do research if necessary, and take on challenges. And that's what I have done. And I feel that my ability to communicate with a number of diverse people across various communities, including the lake, including Nahor Village, Fork Union, Palmyra, Columbia, and Cunningham, are essential to know what's going on and what the challenges are for preservation of our rural landscape. Our particular main area of Quaint Lee Farm, where our house is a very highly developed area and high populated area. But I find that many of the people there also in the communities that surround the farm also agree that we need to work on preserving our rural character. Find Fluvanna has recently come up, which is advertising Fluvanna for tourism and agritourism. So I think that that emphasizes even more the necessity for finding ways to preserve our rural landscape. And that can be done by both conservation easements and ag and forestal districts. So our main area was put in the Bourne Tract Agricultural and Forestal District in 1999, so it's going on 25 years now. Very recently, I found that a neighbor had moved in down the other end of 636, and I'd wanted to put that land in the Ag and Forestal District to say that we are not interested in development of that land and changing the landscape. And when I approached that neighbor, I found them very willing to take on the challenge and to work with me. So three of us then have gotten 400 plus acres in the last and newest of the Ag and Forestal Districts, Quaint Lee of Nahor. Also, the annual comp plan stresses that we should respect our resources as deserving consideration as economic development tools. And that's true, because we need economic development that has proper infrastructure in the right places and that has compatible, notice I said compatible, businesses. So if we want to enhance tourism, we surely need to be sure that we preserve our rural character. That's what conservation easements and ag and forestal districts do. Both send the message that we're not interested in all your money. We want to preserve the open space and the farmland and forest. All people in all areas of Fluvanna seem to agree on this, and they have for decades agreed. and it's included in the current mission statement. That's why my husband and I then have supposedly, as the saying goes, put your money where your mouth is. Well, we put our land where my mouth is right now. And that's every piece of it in an ag and forestal district. I'm a proud Fluvannian of 81 years here and still part of the farming community. I'm grateful that I had the opportunities I had to grow up on a working farm and be a part of the work. My father depended on me. I was his helper in stacking the square bales when we used to do those, because now you can't find any help to help you with them. So we've gone to the big round ones. And moving cattle, loading cattle. And that's why I guess I've never had my fingernails done in my life, because they would not last. It would be a waste of money. So I hope that Fluvanna will be able to offer the same opportunities that I had to other generations. And ag and forestal districts, along with the conservation easements, are perhaps making that hope a reality. So I feel like my entire life on farms, I feel like working on them, moving cattle, I feel like being involved in county business, knowing the comp plan like I know, and the recent issues that are a challenge are all assets. And I would, as a member of the committee, look at all those things and then consider those and encourage ag and forestal districts. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you. Anybody else?
No.
So, actually, if you're not one of the applicants, this is right now just for the applicants to speak.
Oh, I was going to speak for one of the applicants.
It can only be the applicant, but thank you. I feel like I know what you're about to say.
Hi, my name is Robert Stouffer. I live at 356 Richmond Road. I do not have a history in Fluvanna County as long as Ms. Morris. My wife and I moved up here 3.5 years ago from Chesapeake. I was reading the fan mail. The reason I put my name out is I was reading the fan mail and there was a solicitation for people who wanted to serve the county in some capacity. So I was told by Caitlin that I would be under consideration for the Planning Commission, the Agriculture and Forestal Committee, and the Economic Development Committee. My preference was, quite frankly, the Planning Commission. Previous to coming up here, we lived in Chesapeake for 18 years, and for 16 years I was the president of a 1,000 unit homeowners association down there, so I've got pretty extensive experience in, you know, planning for a, you know, large organization, reserve studies and that sort of thing. But anyway, we plan on being in Fluvanna for a while, and so I wanted to volunteer my services for whatever I could do to support the community. I'm a retired Navy officer, just recently, 3 weeks ago, retired from my second career as a government employee, a federal government employee. So I've got a little bit of time on my hands, and I'm just looking forward to whatever I can do to support the community.
Thank you. For your service. Thanks for your service. Anybody else would like to speak? On a side note, Mark Imhoff had messaged me right before coming. He was an incumbent and said he can't make it here, but he definitely still wants to serve. A retired NASA guy who knows a lot about agriculture and carbon and so on.
Well, okay, if nobody else, now here's my question. I figure we got to make at least two separate motions, because when will Mr. Hodges' term end? Because it'll be May 15th. Does it end? What's that?
2026.
Basically, ends
for him as a landowner position?
No, I'm talking about that position that we fill. Oh, so that will be a separate motion from
correct.
The other one.
June 30th, 2026.
June 30th. Yep. So I would like to amend mine to say May 15th, 2024 to June 30th, 2026 for Ms. Morris.
We have a motion. We have a second.
Can I have discussion first?
Do we need a second for discussion?
We need a second.
I'll second. We pointed order the okay. last time that happened.
I
think you
remember.
I tried the point of order.
Yeah. I'll second so we can end.
Okay. Thank you. That's all it takes.
I would love to have Ms. Morris take my position. It's clear with her experience in the community on the Historical Society. She's a two-time FLDP grad. She was on the SBCA board. She worked with the comp plan. She created the new Ag Forestal District. And I'd love to have her in my position. But I would also like to see us put her in one of the longer term positions.
Well, she'd come up for an incumbent position. Okay. I mean, she'd just come back up in 2026.
Okay.
There's not a term on that.
Yeah.
No, I know there's not a term on that.
Yeah, so we just have to vote back on it.
Is there a reason that you were wanting to point her specifically to Tennessee?
Because I think she's got such a great knowledge and background in our county. And I mean, when you're talking about agriculture and forestry, that's what she's done her entire life, besides got me through Spanish in high school. And that was probably a more difficult task than moving all those square bales.
And it was for those reasons that I would rather have her there for a longer term than a shorter term.
He's just saying that you can put her into the other term. The second
I know what he's saying. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, if she starts May today, she'll be there longer. She's got to wait until July 1.
Ms. Morris, I think everybody up here would like to get you into one of these positions.
That's,
are we allowed to ask her
there.
Which one I mean, she would?
Yeah, of course. It's the same position.
I'm not sure what the difference is.
So, there is no difference.
I think what Tim's trying to say is that, and what Mike's trying to say is that she can start literally right this second, but it would only be 2 years. And what Tim is saying is that if we put her on one of the open seats that's available, she would automatically have four, but Mike's saying it wouldn't be able to start until July.
Yeah.
So
if you're looking at length and longevity, as long as we don't vote her off in 2026, going on to dice will allow her a longer time. And I'm not trying to speak for
him.
She may look at us and say, I don't want to do it in 2026. Knowing Ms. Morris, I doubt that.
So it meets so seldom that the odds of something happening between now and July 1 are pretty slim. So I'm just thinking that I'd be surprised if that group meets before July 1.
It's up to him whether he wants to amend his motion. So if he doesn't want to amend his motion, then we take a vote.
I'm fine with it.
I think he's fine with it.
Y'all are killing
me. We've got a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? I think she must have paid off somebody to get on this, but I will vote yes.
Hey, it was a passing grade in 1981.
Thank you for your service.
Speaking of paying someone off.
Start.
Today.
Right now.
All right. So then we need to fill one more position.
You need to fill the first two positions, and so you have one incumbent and then two other individuals, Mr. Singh and Mr. Stouffer.
Two of those three are going to be on.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make a motion. I think Ms. Kilpatrick is another one that's very similar to Ms. Morris.
I'll make that one. Move that Kathleen Kilpatrick be put on the board to serve from 7 July 1st, 2024 to 6/30/2024.
We can go ahead and do both of them, right? Because it's the same term. So who would be the second?
Unless you don't by chance agree on the two.
So, don't agree. Yeah. Mr. Stouffer, do we have a consensus from him?
I didn't. What was the motion?
So keep Ms. Kilpatrick, and who do we put in the other spot?
That's fine. We can do one at a time.
We'll do it one at a time. Can I get a second?
I'll second it. I'm sorry.
Are we seconding Ms. Kilpatrick only?
Just Ms. Kilpatrick.
Give it to Mr.
O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien, and then seconded by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye.
I'm being quiet now.
All right. And then next, we're going to do each incumbent, right?
No, we got to get one more.
We got to get one more on landowners. Oh,
and, yeah, either Mr. Singh or Mr. Stolfer.
Sounded like Tim was.
Well, I mean,
my only comment is Mr. Singh has.
He's applied many times.
So that's my only comment on that.
Is he on EdTac?
He's on I don't want to speak on his behalf. He is on some other boards as well, too.
He's on the EDA, correct?
He is on the EDA.
Planning,
I know we turned him down a couple times.
But he is currently sitting on some boards.
Yes.
Can we get some fresh blood in to see what?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mr. Stouffer, I'm not a from here necessarily, and so, I mean, I think somebody that's been here a short amount of time that season opening wants to serve, and I'd be willing to entertain second kind of motion there or make him.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we appoint Robert Stouffer for the term beginning 1 June 2024 to 30 June 2028 landowner position.
I'll second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
The next one's easy. Two incumbents.
I move that we appoint the two incumbents, Laura Lee and Mark L. Imhoff, to the Ag Forest Hill District Advisory Committee in the land use position, term beginning July 1st, 2024, and ending on June 30th, 2028.
I'll second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes, anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
And then under
congratulations.
Yep, and then under EdTac, you have one position open, and you've got an incumbent seeking reappointment, and then a new application for Ms. Rice. And I don't know if Ms. Rice is here or not. I do not see Ms. Monroe.
No, I don't see her here.
Yep.
I move that we reappoint the incumbent Nina Moore to the economic EdTac. Nina Monroe. Apologies. To the EdTac business representative position for the period 1 July 2024 through 30 June 2027.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Just for the record, it was pointed out that the motion made by Mr. Hodge was start dates of June, but they're actually July.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
July 1. Fiscal year.
Well, you're on the details today.
No, I mean,
I can't take credit for that one.
Did he say?
He said first. So you said, but you're
July
he said June
1st, 2024.
He said June 1st.
That's all.
Okay. Well,
either way, I know the extension.
Okay.
For the terms as presented on the screen.
My record is wrong, or his record is wrong.
All right, moving on to presentations. James River Water Authority bond financing update.
Yeah, this will be really quick. Again, we closed on our VRA, Virginia Resource Authority, 2024 spring bond issuance today. So the all-in true interest cost to borrower bonds was 4.3%, 4.35%. The annual debt service for the JRWA, which is 50-50 Fluvanna-Louisa, is $2.83 million annually. So that annual debt service payment will be split 50-50 between the two localities, with each to pay around $1.42 million a year. With that debt bond issuance, there's about $42.5 million available for project costs. There was $2.1 million set aside for capitalized interest, basically to pay for interest throughout fiscal year 25. So the first debt service payment would be in October 1, 2025, which is fiscal year 2026. There's a requirement through VRA to have a $2.8 million set aside for debt service reserve fund, and that's typical of all VRA projects and stuff for authorities like this. We had it on the original 2017 bond issuance as well. And all project funds, debt service reserve funds are placed in interest-bearing accounts. So as the money gets requisitioned down, funds that are sitting there do earn interest. And so, for instance, on the debt service reserve fund, that $2.8 million, the money that's accrued on that would then be applied as a credit towards debt service payments for the two localities. you know, from a timeline. So, you know, we have all of our, basically all of our permits. We've got a couple, we've got one local permit we're looking to get still on one part of the project. But basically, construction's planning to start, if not by the end of the month, along Barimo Road in some of those areas, 1st of June. But I think it's going to be starting here probably within the next, probably by the end of the month. And per the contract, the construction completion date is September 2026.
Thank you. That's great news. Thank you for all your hard work.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. Like I said, that's all I really had to report. Just wanted to report out on kind of where everything ended up on the closing. And
my only question will be this, and eventually, hopefully, by the time this comes around, we have some kind of word from Dominion as to whether or not they're getting involved.
Yep.
All right.
Any other questions? All right. Moving on to action matters, item C. Advertise public hearing to amend section 9-2-2 and 9-2-4.
Yeah, I'll start a little bit of this. And like I said, Mr. Popowitz, you can come up too and he can add on some things here. You know, a little bit here. So just a little kind of, you know, overview here for the Department of Public Utilities. You know, the Department of Public Utilities oversees operations, maintenance, and repairs for all kind of the county's water and sewer systems. One which includes the Fork Union Sanitary District, the Zions Crossroads Water and Sewer Distribution System, Palmyra Sewer, the Carriagebrook Wastewater Treatment Plant, which serves Carriagebrook Elementary School and basically this building, Social Services Building, Performing Arts Center, and then also Central Wastewater Treatment Plant, which serves Central Elementary, West Central Elementary, and the Middle School. So, Mr. Poppins, do you want to add anything? Did I miss anything for what else you all serve?
No, sir. Other than distribution lines throughout the FUSD system and Zion Crossroads.
Yep. So, this map here, and pardon the direction, but we pulled this out of a recent report. So, the south of the county is to the left. The north of the county is to the right. So, basically, right down here, the James River is kind of right around there.
Here, James, you see right at that corner.
Yeah, right there. Here's Route 15 coming up. Here's the heart of kind of Fork Union. You know, this is Route 6 going back to Scottsville right here. This is Route 6 going back to Goochland. And then this is Route 15 coming up, and we're right around here in this building right now. So this is just kind of showing you the FUSD district boundary line. And then also showing you that we do have some water mains that go outside of that boundary line as well. This map is more appropriate. It's showing north to south, you know, as you see it there. Again, the James is at the south. Up here is going up towards Palmyra. You can see the purple is the CPA, community planning area, and then the hatch marks are the Fork Union Sanitary District boundary lines.
And I will add, you could put in possibly a pick a color right down there between Columbia and the little bend. About halfway is where the water line will be.
The water line will be, right around there. Yeah. Yep, going back there. So again, this is the item before you is regarding increasing Fork Union Sanitary District water rights and charges. So the chart here shows you basically the history of water rates and how they have changed going back to 1986. So you can see in the column it says current rates. The current rate for minimum charge for 2,000 gallons is $21, and everything above that per 1,000 gallons is $11. I actually brought this to the board back in, it was April of 2020 to increase the rates at the time, or it was right around that time, but then COVID happened, and it didn't seem like a good idea at that point to increase rates on customers as kind of, the whole economy was kind of uncertain at the time. So we put a pause on it, and now we're back here before the board again. And Mr. Poppins, do you want to speak upon the proposed rates?
Sure. Currently, we have a base rate for the first 2,000 gallons, $21. what we're proposing is that we go to $24. That's a $3 increase for everyone, basically. And then on the additional rates, you're looking at 22 cents. For the average customer, that's going to be an increase of about $3.22 per month. It's not going to be a huge increase, and I don't believe it's outrageous, and I think that it's appropriate that we try to get hit all the customers with that small increase rather than trying to do it on the backside with some of our larger customers. We don't have that many larger customers right now, but you know, as time comes on, maybe we could look at a different rate structure for Fuzzy, but I believe that this is pretty fair, and it's not going to, I don't believe it's going to break the bank for anybody.
And then this chart here just kind of shows you kind of, as Mr. Popowitz said, you know, kind of shows some of the, you know, potential impacts for different customers and their usage. Again, if you're up to that 2,000 gallons per month, you can see your monthly bill goes up $3 per month, or roughly $36 a year. As Mr. Popowitz stated, you know, he noted the $3.22, because that is roughly, Mr. Popowitz, you said roughly a little more than 3,000 gallons per month is kind of the average user. But you can see some larger users, which we don't have a whole lot of larger users, but you can see what the monthly increase. From an annual standpoint, off to the left, you know, it's going to amount to about a $20,000 per year additional annual revenue for the system at this point. And so this would probably be a first step to look at. I know Mr. Popowitz, I know they've certainly encountered some system issues recently that cost money. And again, it's an old system, and you know, they're doing a lot to keep the old system going. And, you know, partially too, as we look at the Fork Union Water Supply Project, we're hoping too, as that kind of comes on board, we can kind of augment some of the systems that are in place right now to make for a more more robust long-term system.
Correct.
So if we, so let's say this averages out, we get 20 grand extra in a year. So in just operating costs every year, if nothing broke, would we have been in the black or the red?
We would have been in the black.
Okay.
But like I said, we do have those issues in the system. It is an older system. Some places 50 years old. In fact, one of the big items that we had this year was near the 2.5-inch line that feeds the Dominion Power Plant, they are still using water, obviously, over there because they're definitizing the site. That was 3,000 foot of pipe that was completely bad. It was so old and been scoured out so badly that one of the workers had gone out there just to kind of lift up a little bit, and his shovel ended up actually, from the weight of the pipe, it slid through the pipe. So it sliced it in half. And then we found out that as we were trying to repair the same pipe, we started with 500 foot, and then we ended up with 3,000 feet because the pipe kept breaking further and further down the line. So we're going to have those issues throughout the system, mainly because when this system was first started, they didn't have things like buffering chemicals and things like that, and it caused a lot of scouring in some of these older pipes. So especially in your plastic pipes and your PVCs from the 70s and 80s, those are thinner walled than the stuff we get today. So you know, we're expecting to have to find monies for major repairs over time. We also have a section of concrete asbestos pipe that we'd like to replace at some point. We haven't had any issues with it, and it's safe as long as there's water running through it, but it's certainly something we want to also replace. And it's an 8-inch line, so it'd be a bigger line than, say, our typical line, which is about 6 inches throughout the system.
Yeah, I mean, so previously to this year, yes, they were running a surplus. They were maintaining. This year, there's definitely some challenges we're working through right now from some end of the year funds and stuff like that.
So every year until this year has been a surplus.
Well, I would say no, because actually the county provided a loan to FUSD. I want to say going back to I want to say maybe 09 or 2010 period, and there was probably about a five-year period where they were not running a surplus. The county was having to help with some of the system and help some with some of the financial components. They got to a point where they ended up basically, there was, the county provided a note payable to the system, and then that was paid back to the county. And so since that point, I want to say that was probably around 2016, 2017, they have been in the black and running, you know, financially, you know, in a good position. This year, they have certainly encountered some challenges.
Yeah, that was where Wayne Stevens worked out the increase to get that note paid back.
Yep.
Where do they stand on reserves? So if we have another catastrophic incident, do they have sufficient reserves to overcome that?
I would say at this point, no. They do not, and that's the thing. That's what we're working through right now. There are some. If you remember, we received some Dominion money up front as part of the project. We think some of the repairs that Mr. Popowitz was discussing, we think some of that upfront advance money can be utilized towards some of that, which is a pretty substantial six-figure amount that we're looking at. So we're looking through that, and, you know, Mr. Witten looked at some of the proffer language, and again, you know, the proffer language talks about installing new pipe within a radius of the plant, and again, that's exactly what they did when they had to replace that pipe. They installed brand new pipe around that area, which is within the radius. So we're looking at potentially bringing forward a supplemental to the board to utilize some of those funds to offset some of these challenges. But again, you know, they've encountered a few other issues too within the system, and nothing of you know, health and safety, but it's an old system, so it's starting to show its age. And so, you know, want to make sure that the system has the adequate funds in the interim to do those necessary repairs as they come due. And then too, as we're looking at the Fork Union water supply system, to make sure that we've got a better long-term system as well.
So if we get another 20 grand this year and don't have anything catastrophic or a notable repair, but it seems like we're going to start having notable repairs. I mean, I'm just wondering if $20,000 is doing anything to prepare for that.
I don't know if it's, I mean, again, if I would hate to put forward an increase that was a shocker to citizens right now. And so I think while they're working on the system, while we're analyzing what these kind of how they're going to end up this year, after we look at some bringing some of those funds in to offset some of those large repairs on that system. Again, we may need to look at this again in a year from now. Back in 2014, the board had asked at that point to come up with a plan to look at the rates every 2 years for a rate increase. And again, when I came here in 2019 in this position, I came forward with the rate increase in 2020, but again, it was COVID, so it didn't happen. So now that we're kind of outside of that, you know, that's why we're bringing this forward. And again, we will certainly be monitoring this, and, you know, Mr. Popowitz and his team are doing all they can to keep the system in fair condition and fair operational condition. But I think from a financial standpoint, it's something that we have to look at, and maybe this 20 grand, again, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a ton of money, but so we're going to really have to look at that to see is this type of increase going to hold for a while.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, having that extra revenue, would, if we did have to take a loan out under FSD, you know, that should cover, you know, for something in the like the six digits.
Yeah. The one nice thing too is actually within two fiscal years, there is an outstanding note payable, I think, for the FSD system that is maturing, that will be paid off.
Yeah, USDA.
Yeah.
USDA loan. In fact, we had to do some things down at the building to make sure that we were still in compliance with the loan requirements.
I'm not at all proposing this. Just putting it out there. I mean, $3 is pretty minimum. And when I think of $6 for you know, if I heard $6 a month when this presentation was first made, that's how much it increased per household. I think, well, that's pretty cheap. When I think of the $3 to $6 doubles additional revenue, goes from 20,000 to 40,000, it's a pretty big, doubling our buffer for short money.
If I remember correctly, and that's a long time ago, when we first got on the board, I think the rates, when Mr. Stevens proposed this, went from 11 to 22. I think we almost doubled the rates.
This is the history of the rates right here on this chart.
Okay, you got it.
I mean, I think it's pretty consistent with what.
All right. So I was wrong.
And again, using percentages, the 21 to the 24, that's a 14% increase. And again, over 10 years, it's probably not outrageous. We have another system that had some increases recently. So,
the thing you got to do is you have to balance the affordability and the levy on the people, and you don't want to make the mistake where you get in a position where you can't maintain the system and you have to have an outside entity come in, and then suddenly $3 or $6 doesn't look so bad. So
yeah,
I'm kind of acutely aware of this, and whatever we can do to make sure that they have the reserves they need for catastrophic failure and have a plan long term for replacing these pipes in the ground that are aging, that he says has, they're wearing down, they're getting thinner, we're experiencing this. I do not want to have us in a position where we have to let this go to an outside firm. I want to do everything we can now to strike that balance between taking care of the citizens and taking care of the system that supports the citizens.
The one thing to think about too, one, Fork Union Sanitary District, it's a sanitary district. So it has, as it says, it has special authorities given into it because it is a sanitary district. Again, the board is the governing body for the sanitary district, so it's got taxing authority. The board could say, we want to impose a different tax for those that are within the district. Now, up to this point, as long as I've been here, the board's never been interested in doing that, so it's always kind of come down to increasing the fees and stuff like that. And a little bit, when you look at that too, because there are customers that are outside of the sanitary district.
I was going to say, that's the main reason we did, because there's some customers outside of the sanitary district that have water.
Yeah.
There's some customers inside the sanitary district that don't have water.
Yeah.
So,
and honestly, from a long-term standpoint, we have these other systems. We have Zion's Crossroads systems. We have the Palmyra system. At some point, it may make sense for the sanitary district not to be a sanitary district, because if you're not using the special authorities, the taxing authority and some other things, is there a benefit of having a sanitary district in the system if those authorities are not going to be implemented? And so maybe once the debt falls off, maybe it rolls into the Department of Public Utilities, just like every other system, like the Zion's Crossroads system and the Palmyra Sewer system.
Well, I didn't want to go there, but when you brought it up earlier with the new system coming in, and what does the future of the sanitary district look like with that? It used to be sort of this standalone thing that was, and now there's just, I think of it as like a Venn diagram. It used to kind of be here, and now it's kind of, and the more systems we put online and the more things we do, it just kind of bleeds over. I've had several conversations just trying to kind of conceptualize how it's separate from the public utilities, but it's run by public utilities, but it's actually a separate, sanitary.
I'm sorry not to interrupt, but all of those systems, again, when you have debt proceeds taken out, for instance, the Zion's Crossroads system and the Palmyra system, they're what's called in an enterprise fund. You have to track them separately as a budget, almost like its own separate budget. And the debt proceeds that are taken out require that to be done that way. So you do have these separate systems that are tracked differently, but all of the people that run these systems are all public utilities employees. And the employee that does water stuff on the FUSDI system may also do water stuff on the Zion's Crossroads system. And, there's a lot of cross-training and a lot of cross cross-servicing of all these different systems. So maybe what was once in the day the standalone system, they are very much all kind of under the public utilities umbrella right now.
And when does that debt run out?
For theirs, I want to say it's either fiscal year 26 or fiscal year 27.
Yeah, I believe it's 20. I think it's like the beginning of 27.
Yeah.
And so a couple of things. I mean, one is, as you said, you have Dominion monies that maybe it will be allocated.
Yep.
Two, you didn't find any mop heads in the system. That's not why the rate is so low.
Not in the water system anyway.
No, dumped oil or anything like that. The $3 increase is would be welcome to people at the lake. We had a $35 increase, which is their current rate. So it's more than welcome. The average increase over the last 40 years has been 2%. For the system, the average increase for most public utility systems, about 3.3%, 3.6%. So we're a little bit below the average increase for public utilities.
You're talking about Fuzzy?
Talking about Fuzzy. But in general, there's, I think, while we could increase the rate, to your point of, does a $20,000 make a difference? Ultimately, we can revisit it, and it sounds like there'll be some additional ways to look at it down the road. So I don't know that, unless he's expecting a catastrophic failure, this year, I don't know that it would make a difference if we increased it to $3 or not.
Yeah, if we were to have another catastrophic failure like we had there, we would just have to figure out a way to pay for that.
Come to the board.
No matter how much we increase, you can't increase the rates far enough to take care of something that happens.
Sorry, just didn't interrupt. In immediate, I agree. While if that event happened 3 years from now, another $60,000, $60,000 is instead of $120,000 3 years from now. That's pretty notable. Yeah. $120,000 fits into that catastrophic or close to it.
Yeah,
you would like to take the revenues that are being generated and borrow against those revenues. Yeah. So that's what you would likely do if it was a major increase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's it for the water rates. Also, there is a as part of this ordinance change, there's a look to change the water charges connection fees. Mr. Pop is going to speak about that.
Yeah, currently our connection fee and availability fee together are about $4,500. If we had to do a bore, it cost us every bit of that and maybe a little more. So we're losing money on those connection fees. We thought that $6,500 was about where we need to be. It gives us a little bit of extra if we find some other things we need to do out there. It pays for any type of boring and anything like that. So,
and just as a comparison, the Zions Crossroads system, this connection fee, the lowest connection fee is $8,500.
Why would we not make them the same?
The only reason is because kind of two different systems a little bit in that, you're really, from the Zions Crossroads system, you're really looking for connections from a commercial standpoint, whereas from the FUSD system, it doesn't really have the capacity for that. And so the $6,500, as discussed, was still somewhat affordable for the average homeowner without going to that kind of next level where it kind of gets out of that realm of being somewhat affordable.
Are they required to go on the system?
In Fork Union,
district.
They are only required to go on the system if it is, and I don't know the distance. It's so much. There's so many.
Feet.
How much feet?
I believe it's 400 feet.
I think that's, Mr. Pop is correct. 400 feet from a trunk line?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Within 400.
Within 400 feet of a trunk line.
Yeah,
correct.
If you're beyond the 400 feet, you can dig a well.
How many people did you put online last year?
Off the top of my head, I believe we put five or six. But some of those houses haven't been sold or whatever. It's development that's come from a couple of housing places. So.
Where was that? Was that CC Road or?
Winswell Road.
Winswell Road, yeah.
They just put up that, put up a bunch of houses right there.
Yeah.
Double wides down that road.
Yeah. Down from the
drive-in.
Yeah.
And before we had like three or four that were right on Route 15 and 6 as you come around to Gordon's Fork Union.
So my question is the $6,500 connection charge, you said we were losing money, or is that going to
On some, on,
draw even, or?
Actually, we don't lose money on every connection. It depends. Most of the time, if we have to do a bore, it's well over this $4,500 we charge. It's usually right around $6,500, about $6,000, depending on who we get to do the bore. And on the other ones, we, you know, we do our own in-house, but then we've got charges for the saddle, the time for the guys. We've got to put in new boxes, dig that, put in new meters, and also with the labor, depending on how hard it is, I would imagine it's somewhere right around $3,000 to do, just do the regular system part, where we have to tap in ourselves.
Is that eight in Zions, is that, whether it's commercial or residential, it's $8,000?
No, it's based upon the connections, based upon the pipe size.
Yeah.
So if you have a bigger pipe size, again, it goes up from there.
So wouldn't that be mostly residential at eight in,
yes,
in that area?
Meaning
the ones that are eight? If
it's the ones that are 85, those are, it's around, it's a comparable, I think it's a 3/4 inch connection.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a, I think a 3/4 inch connection, is that
3/4 inch or 5/8.
Yeah. So they're comparable size connections. I mean, the larger size of connection fee, the more water capacity you can have.
So at 8,500, is it likely to be residential?
No. No, at Zions, no.
So business could be, there's plenty of businesses that could be getting
smaller, $8,500. Oh, yes.
Yes, smaller businesses. And
your smaller office buildings or something like that, yeah.
So something like a Wawa or whatever.
So is the increase there included into the... into the 20,000, or is that
no. This is separate, and again, you don't really know what this is.
Right.
It all depends on connections, mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was many years where we didn't have any connections in the system,
yeah.
And then, as Mr. Popwood said, I think you said six the past year.
Yeah. So it just depends on what the development's doing.
Yeah. So that's kind of hard to. You can't really bet on that those dollars as much as you can on the water service charges.
Yeah. And we do have people that are buying and selling too, so that doesn't count into those, into that connection fee, because those have already been paid years ago.
So is that part of the motion?
What's that? So the motion. So again, let me just pull up the ordinance. And again, so here again, this area right here deals with the changes in the monthly water service charges. Again, you see the 24 and the change to 1122. And then down below here talks about the $6,500. So those are the changes in the ordinance. And then that's the motion right there pertaining to those two sections of the ordinance. And Mr. Whitten can certainly answer any questions specific to the ordinance.
The only thing I want to add, it would go into effect July 1st.
Yes.
If it passes after the public hearing.
The one thing I'll say about this is we know the economics of the vast majority.
Yeah.
Of the area.
Yeah, I mean, and that was, you know, a concern. I met with some of the folks from Public Utilities for lunch yesterday just to kind of gain a better understanding, you know, really of the system, and most of the folks that are on the system are on a fixed income. And so, you know, obviously when you see a rate increase that affects, what is it, I think 500 people are on the system.
Yeah,
correct.
498.
Yeah, 498.
Is that connections? I'm sorry. 498 connections.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, but at the end of the day, I probably, you know, there's certain things that you have to do and to cover yourself when certain things come. And I probably wouldn't have been on board with a $6 increase, knowing the folks down there that are footing this bill. But I think $3 is responsible in the sense that it does provide some extra income for the system. At the same time, you know, I get a lot of calls about, you know, can you come flush my system, or have them come flush my system, or who should I reach out to? And I think that if some of this can go towards fixing some of those more minor things that can help make the services a little bit better, that, you know, ultimately there's a positive outcome there.
I mean, like the comment I made, I'm acutely aware of the situation those folks are in, but I think if you went back 10, 15, 20 years and asked most people that live in and around Lake Monticello, would you rather have a $3, $4, or $5 raise or what you have today, they will have taken those incremental raises to keep the system operating and in the control of local people and not taken over by a larger corporation that sole intent is to make profit.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No. I would not want to see that mistake happen again. And the people down there could not.
Mr. Jones is going to make a motion.
I'd like to move that the Board of Supervisors advertise a public hearing on June 20th, 2024 to amend Section 9-2-2 and 9-2-4 of the County Code to increase Fort Canyon Sanitary District water rates and charges.
Go ahead. No, it's your district.
Your district.
I'll second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. Goad. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Thank you.
All right, item D, resolution.
So Mr. Chair, so it's 7 o'clock, and so I think we probably need to jump to the public hearings at this point, and then we'll have to come back to items D, E, and F after the public hearing.
Okay. Public hearing, we'll go to item G. Public hearing to amend 2-1-5 of the county code to increase court costs. Mr. Whitten.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. So Virginia Code Section 53.1-120 was amended in 2020 to increase the maximum cost in each criminal or traffic case in the district and circuit courts from $10 to $20. And the funds have to be used for courthouse security personnel and, if requested by the sheriff, for equipment and other personal property used in connection with courthouse security. So under this proposed amendment to Section 2-1-5, the cost would increase from $10 to $20 in each criminal or traffic case in district and circuit courts. And the sheriff could request that the funds also be used for equipment and other personal property used in connection with courthouse security. So the estimated revenue is around $10,000 to $15,000. The ordinance would go into effect July 1st. The clerk of court had requested that we have a delay just so she could put everything in the system. So she requested a delay until July 1st. Are we happy to answer any questions?
Can we roll these on with us?
Well, I'm not trying to make this long, but it would be interesting to see how much those costs are in other counties around here.
My prior locality, we increased it from $10 to $20 in 2020. I didn't do any research whether all the adjacent counties increased it. I know a lot of localities increased it in 2020 when they had that authority.
And some of them, their local code may have been silent on it, so it moved by default. But in just the past few years, we've had the cameras go out, the access control system needs to be replaced, so there are issues in the courthouse. The Sally Port door had to be fixed. There's tons of things. You know, the courthouse is reaching an age where you're having to put a little bit of work into it, too, so...
Yeah, and then technology doesn't get any cheaper, that's for certain.
It sure does not. And the sound system had to be replaced. So there's things that had to be done.
All right.
You got to have a public hearing. You got to open the public hearing.
Got out of order.
Sure. All right. Questions from the board? Heard from the applicant. We'll have the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is anybody wishing to speak? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to the County Code to amend Section 2-1-5 to increase the cost of in each criminal or traffic case in the district and circuit courts from $10 to $20.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan, seconded by Mr. Goad. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
I think all four of us can get a motion and a second in here.
I know, you guys are all motioning to increase taxes now.
All right, we'll go to item H, public hearing to enact 2-1-6 of the county code to authorize a regional jail processing fee. Mr. Whitaker.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This was another fee that was requested by the clerk of court. So basically, section 15.2-1613.1 of the Code of Virginia authorizes a processing fee of $25 on any individual admitted to the regional jail following conviction in general district or circuit court. And the fee, which is part of the court cost, will be deposited into the treasurer's account and will be used by the sheriff's office to defray the cost of transporting and processing the arrested persons into the regional jail. So the proposed amendment to enact section 2-1-6 would authorize the processing fee of $25 on any individual admitted to the Central Virginia Regional Jail. So the estimated revenue would be $3,000 to $5,000 annually, and the ordinance would go into effect July 1st of 2024. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, so then open this for public hearing.
Public hearing again, yep.
All right, we have no presentations on it. We'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Is that a motion?
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve amendments to the county code to enact section 2-1-6 to authorize a $25 processing fee on any individual admitted to a regional jail following conviction.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Board votes aye, 5-0. We will go on to item I, public hearing to amend 20-6-1, 20-6-2, and 20-6-3 to authorize recordation fee. Ms. Wooden?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the board. This is another ordinance that was requested by the clerk of court. So the Virginia Code section 58.1-3805 does authorize the Board of Supervisors to charge a $25 fee for the recordation of a list of heirs pursuant to section 64.2-509 or an affidavit pursuant to 64.2-510 as provided in 58.1-1717.1. So the proposed code amendment to code section 20-6-1 would charge the $25 fee for the recordation of a list of heirs or an affidavit unless the will has been probated for the decedent or there's been a grant of administration on the decedent's estate. The estimated revenue would be $1,000 annually, and the ordinance will go into effect July 1st, 2024. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Anybody?
No.
All right, we'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments 5 minutes on topic and direct them to the board. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to County Code Section 20-6-1, 20-6-2, and 20-6-3 to authorize a fee of $25 per recordation of a list of heirs pursuant to Section 64.2-509 or an affidavit pursuant to Section 64.2-510.
A motion and a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hyde, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Board votes aye, 5-0. We'll move on to item J, public hearing to amend 4-2-2 and 4-2-5 of the county code to add a definition of a violation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So this code amendment is to section 4-2-2 and 4-2-5. So the first section was we made amendments back in September regarding the prohibition on dogs running at large to make it countywide. And then the section 4-2-5 was enacted in January regarding basically leash law, which was designated for the county parks. So when I first went into court on the first running at large case, so basically right now in Lake Monticello, you can be found guilty on your first violation, but outside Lake Monticello was the third violation. So the judge had questions, what is a violation? Is it each time you come to court, or is it each time the animal control deputy writes out a criminal incident report, which was my interpretation. So the person was still found guilty, but for future cases, or if there was a substitute judge, I thought it made sense to define violations so there'd be no confusion. So basically, in this ordinance, it does define a violation as each time the sworn law enforcement officer completes the criminal incident report. And so that would clarify the intent of the ordinance. So this would be for the leash law violations at Pleasant Grove Park and the running a large ordinance, which is countywide. Happy to answer any questions.
For each of these type items, do you run all those by the judge?
Yeah, well, they all, once the animal control deputy swears out the summons, then it goes to court, and then I can prosecute it. If I'm not available, then the animal control deputy can prosecute it as well.
So did this come from a case going in front of the judge?
Correct.
Okay, I see. Okay.
And so basically, general district court judge here used to be in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in Orange, and there the person would be found guilty on the first violation. Where here it's a little bit different because it's the third violation. So that's why she had questions. She had never seen the third violation before you can be found guilty. That was kind of unusual language. So that's the way a little clarity to the ordinance would make sense.
Other questions, thoughts?
Happen quickly.
All right.
We've already had two cases in court for running at large in the county. And both of them were multiple instances, four or five times the animal control deputy had been out there. And hopefully the problem will go away with those individuals.
I'm sure it's not touching a lot of people, but when it is getting abused, there's something to address it.
They have the ability if somebody's abusing it.
Yeah.
Or just being a jerk of a neighbor.
We'll open a public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anybody wishing to speak? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing.
This month.
It's yours, brother.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to Section 4-2-2 and Section 4-2-5 of the County Code to clarify the definition of a violation under both the dog running at large ordinance and the unrestricted dog ordinance.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goad, second by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Board votes aye, 5-0. So we'll hop back up to the item D, correct?
Correct.
Resolution under action matters, resolution to extend the due date for real estate taxes, personal property taxes, public service taxes, machinery and tools taxes, and vehicle license fees to June 21, 2024. Mr. Witten?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. So County Code Section 20-1-2 states that the taxes on real property and personal property are due in equal installments on June 5th and December 5th. And then Section 15-2-3 states the license fee on vehicles is due June 5th as well. So the treasurer made a request last week. The time, she wasn't sure the exact date that the bills would be mailed out. She wasn't sure if it would be the beginning of this week or the end of this week. So she had requested an extension of the due date from June 5th to June 21st. I talked to the treasurer's office this morning, and the bills were mailed out Monday. And people are already starting to receive them, and they're already starting to get calls. So the Commissioner of Revenue said he already received 150 calls when I talked to him earlier today. So people are already receiving the bills and calling. So the extension would give the taxpayers extra time to receive the bill in the mail and to come in and pay it or mail in a check.
And I think Ms. Rittenhouse is in the back of my eyes.
Okay, yes. I didn't see her back there.
Ms. Rittenhouse is in the back.
I thought she was just another high schooler, right?
She's upset, yo.
All right, any discussion?
I did get all my bills.
I'm not. I think this was, do we still need to do that?
Do we still need to do June 21st?
Yeah.
Would you please come up? Ms. Rittenhouse.
I just put that pressure on you.
Well, I was going to say,
I think she had requested it before they got them mailed out. But when they got them mailed out again, that's my only. Because do we know what time or what day they went out last year? We've got to be within 5 days of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're close to last year.
It was pretty close to last year. I didn't get a definite on when it went out.
Yeah.
But we just had so many problems with Munis and getting everything in the go-alongs. Just
would you pull the mic up to you? I think
I'm sorry, but how about that?
There you go.
We just had so many problems with Munis. I just could not get a clean file. Had we been able to get a clean file, we probably could have had them out at the beginning of the month.
but being as it was so late, I just didn't feel like it was fair to the taxpayer. We did have a lot of people call today because I even got mine. So, but then again, I did get calls, people still asking where's my tax bill. We got to give them time. And I was thinking about people like, say, the school system, well, their payday is on the 20th. So that gives them one pay period to get it together. And a lot of times they like that extra time to use a couple of pay periods to be able to pay for it if it's a large amount. So that was the reason.
And this did affect both the Commissioner of Revenue and Treasurer's Office, right?
Yeah, the Commissioner of the Revenue had a really hard time. Seems like Tim could probably explain that part of it better. But it was late getting to us. I don't think we got it till like the very last, the tail end of April, and then we started finding out all the problems that we were having.
So. Just to elaborate on that.
I mean, it's clearly not any one person's fault. Munis is owned by Tyler. They create the software. Any municipality in America can ask for changes to it, and it looks like other municipalities made changes, and the written procedures that they had for generating the tax bills didn't work. The Commissioner of Revenue's office had issues when Tyler didn't like the input file that came from the valuations on used personal property. So, I mean, there's been issues all along, not no fault of anyone employed by the county. They did everything they could. It's not IT's fault, it's not any county's fault, it's not Eric's fault, it's not our fault. And I have, from when I work for the county, I've seen how horrible our mail system is. There would be times that people would postmark their bills to come into the office, and you go by the postmark date, whether it's on time, and they'll be receiving them in December and January with postmarks prior to December 6th. So this is part of the reason, even though they got out, some people got them, there may be bags of mail still in Richmond and people won't get it until the last minute. So unless there's a very pressing reason why we wouldn't extend it, my question would be, why don't we just make it 30 June?
I was gonna bring that up too, just because Ms. Rittenhouse kind of laid foundation for what I was gonna say there. I know, I mean, schools are paid on 20th, I mean, and I know there's some people that get paid twice a month, whether that's, you know, every 2 weeks or, you know, the halfway through the month or the last day of the month. I mean, this would just kind of give, that would give them one extra, if you're on a two a month pay cycle, it would give you an extra pay period to sort of meet that. And I don't know when they went out last year. Brad from the post office today in Fork Union texted me and said that there were some going out in Fork Union today. I think if we, you know, could find a way to confirm that everybody's already gotten theirs, you know, I've had people ask me, even family members, that don't like paying taxes at all. I don't think any of us do, but hey, you know, when's my bill coming in so I can go ahead and get a head start on that? And I know you can always get an early head start on it and you know, pay it. You know, you generally know what you're going to be paying. But I'd be more in favor of going of pushing it back than not extending it at all.
Does that create any hardships? Or?
Well, so let me just kind of give a couple points. So the reason June 21st was selected, it kind of went back to then what was the time frame that was given last year, and then trying to apply that same amount of time, pushing it back a little bit to allow, you know, basically a month to provide payment to taxes this year. So that's kind of where the June 21st came in. The only hiccup with getting it so close to the date, I mean, one, June 30th, I don't even know what...
That's a Sunday.
That's a Sunday. Yeah,
so it would need to be a weekday.
It would probably have to be like June 28th or something like that. The only issue you're getting, you know, you're getting very close to the end of the fiscal year, and so if everything doesn't come in time, you know, it could potentially affect some end-of-the-year numbers a little bit. That was really the only reason... You know, if you push it back, it could have some impact necessarily on that.
So somebody mails it on the 27th or 28th.
Well, if they post,
any delay.
Well, if they postmark it, then you have to go by the postmark date.
Yeah.
But say they just pay it late because we're pushing it back further. If someone's going to pay it late, even to begin with, now you may be paying it late into a different fiscal year, and that could have some impact on, you know, financials for this fiscal year. So that's why there was a discussion not trying to push it right up to the end, And I'll just make one other comment, and then I'll zip it. So the bills that went out, the date is June 5th on them. So, you know, there may be some confusion, I don't know, from the public of, you know, is it due June 5th or is it due June 21st? And so if the board approves this to the 21st, you know, we're going to have to get some information out about it being extended. But again, with getting information out all the time, I'm not sure everyone's going to see that. So I think there's going to be some confusion. There may be some confusion that my bill says June 5th, but oh, by the way, I see that, or maybe I don't see that it's been extended or something
like
that.
But they didn't have that confusion at the beginning of COVID when we did exactly the same thing by moving the date.
I think when those bills went out, the date was on them at that
point. And we weren't able to change the date this time, correct?
No.
So we talked about we could put it on the website, we could put it in the Flavanna Review to let people know the date.
Yeah, I mean, we could send it out in fan mail, we could put it on the website, we could push it out as much as we can, within reason.
I'm not trying to be heartless when I say this, because I'm a school teacher.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll just leave it at that. But everybody knows June 5th and December 5th. Everybody knows those days. And yeah, we might be a weight behind. And what probably is something that we should look at is possibly having, since we know Munis is an issue, having our due date for when we set the rate 1 week earlier.
That would make our budget time a little compressed.
That's the only thing I'm looking at.
Yeah.
I mean, because this seems to be an issue that we have quite often.
I know Augusta County had the same issue, and they delayed their due date to June 21st as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure they probably.
I have no problem doing it. I've done it before because we did it with COVID.
Tyler's a problem everywhere.
Was it Tyler?
Can't get away from it.
I don't know for sure. Most localities use Tyler.
Yep.
Let's make the motion. Let's get on.
What you gonna do?
Well, go ahead, Tom.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the resolution to extend the due date for real estate taxes, personal property taxes, public service taxes, machineries and tools taxes, and vehicle licenses fees from June 5th, 2024 to June 21st, 2024.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Goat. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Item E, resolution to adopt the VDOT secondary six-year plan. Mr. Goat.
This will be really quick. Again, so since we haven't changed anything in the six-year plan, and because we get less than $100,000 every year from VDOT from funds, if we don't have any changes, and because we have less than $100,000, we don't have to have a public hearing, but the board has to adopt a resolution basically recognizing that that's the case. And so this is really, it's really administrative a little bit in that, I mean, and again, if you go back to the document, again, under this, well, this is the resolution. Again, this is kind of this resolution that was in the board package. Oh, I'm sorry, there's two resolutions. Anyway, the secondary six-year plan, there was no changes from previously, and we have to, the board has to approve a resolution acknowledging that there's no changes.
I move to adopt the VDOT six-year secondary improvement plan and budget resolution for 2024-25 through 2029-30, and the VDOT construction priority list 2024-25 as required by sections 33.1-23 and 33.1-23.4 of the 1950 Code of Virginia.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 4 with 0.
4-0-1.
Oh, nice. All righty.
I thought you were still on that.
Item F, fiscal year 24, fiscal year 25, Savannah County Public Schools, CIP budget.
Yeah,
Mr. Shriver?
Dr. Gretz.
He'll be too back here.
And again, I'll just do this. I got one slide and it's easy. Again, the Fluvanna County Public Schools, they're requesting an appropriation of $850,000 moved from the projects that were approved in fiscal year 25 for the middle school track, the high school track, and the high school turf replacement. Move those, a portion of those funds to fiscal year 24, so they could start doing some of the work prior to the fiscal year beginning July 1. That's always kind of an issue with some of their CIP projects, especially those that are of more of a timely nature. When we approve the budget for July 1, they can't start until July 1. So on the chart here just shows what they're requesting. So they're requesting $30,000 of the $443,000 approved for the high school track. They're requesting $295,000 out of the $455,000 for the FCHS turf, and then requesting $525,000 out of the $1,060,000 for the Fluvanna Middle School track. And I will hand it over to Dr. Gretz from here for specifics.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. I really don't have anything to add. I mean, this is something that we really should have thought about beforehand and brought to you. I'll own that mistake. I'm sorry for not doing that. And as many of these as I've done, that was a rookie mistake on my part. That said, this enables the company to mobilize in June so that we can get the project done before everything starts in August.
So we play football.
So that's important. Weren't we originally thinking it was going to come in around 25% of the total spend?
You're talking about like what was needed early?
What was needed early?
I think the 25% was probably just
a guesstimate.
I'm assuming. I don't think there was any hard science behind that.
It's not like we're giving more money. We're just giving them money early enough to start so that we can go use the facilities when we open school on the 13th. What day do we open?
You had to ask me that.
It's close enough. We'll say 15th, somewhere in there. 13th.
Construction done and have the equipment out of there before school starts.
What's that?
You'd want to have the construction done and have the equipment out before the students.
Because I think that the way the rules are going to go, the one thing that we've talked about with summer conditioning for football is we can't use anything north of the gate.
Yeah.
I don't think we go back there at all. So, I mean.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for this company. I mean, I have the updated figures from them, AstroTurf. But I think the thing that's really non-negotiable for them, as is always the case when these companies are mobilizing, is ordering the asphalt, building the turf itself. I mean, if this board wanted to consider something different than what's being requested here, there's probably flexibility. Again, I don't want to speak for them, but I do know that when they have to order things, and you'll see that's the majority of the cost, is the equipment's being ordered. It's not the mobilization. It's not the... So, do you have questions for me? Is there information I can give you that would help you with this consideration?
I'm ready to make a motion.
All right. I mean, nothing else that we have to do except this, is it, or do we have to make some kind of adjustment to our...
So there's three motions, and what these motions do, they basically, each motion addresses each CIP project, because again, each CIP project was approved individually, and it basically, the motion takes into account what you do for fiscal year 24, and then takes into account reducing the CIP approved for fiscal year 25 by that same amount.
I move the board.
Can I just one last question? Sorry, Debbie. And it's a little bit unrelated, but with the track, were you all able to upgrade to the softer material, do you know, on the track with the padding under the?
I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry,
Debbie.
I move the board of supervisors approve a supplemental appropriation of $30,000 from unassigned fund balance for the FY24 FCHS track resurfacing / milling CIP, and further decrease the FY25 FCHS track resurfacing milling CIP budget appropriation by $30,000.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. 5-0.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a supplemental appropriation of $295,000 from unassigned fund balance for the fiscal year 24 FCHS football field turf replacement and further decrease the fiscal year 25 FCHS football field turf replacement CIP budget appropriation by $295,000.
Second. Motion made by Mr. Hodge, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. 5-0.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve a supplemental appropriation of $525,000 from unassigned fund balance for the FY24 FMS track resurfacing milling and further decrease the FY25 FMS track resurfacing milling budget appropriation by $525,000.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goetz, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. All right, moving to the consent agenda. Anybody have anything you want to pull?
Yes, I have two items. The first one was item P, fiscal year 24, Fort Union Fire Department property damage insurance claim. The only thing I wanted to raise on that, I didn't have an issue with it because it's an insurance claim, but the question I had was, do we not have procedures in place where they utilize a spotter to keep them from backing into the building? And should the Department of Emergency Services or Emergency Management Coordinator implement such policy to prevent this from happening in the future?
So speaking, and again, Ms. Melton, do you know specifically, let me just look at the, so again, this was a Mr. True thing for the Emergency Services Department. I know that he has said in conversations before that they've got protocols for spotters. I don't know what happened specifically on this, but I know he does have protocols in place. So what I'm assuming is a protocol wasn't followed and maybe there was some, maybe there was a discussion about the protocol not being followed from a personnel standpoint. I can't speak anymore and I don't know the specifics of it. And Ms. Melton, are you?
Good evening. I do believe there are procedures in place for that, but again, I'm not sure without Mr. Drew being here to answer that.
I know this, I can tell you that he does have procedures for that because I remember we've had a conversation about something else. So I don't know what happened on this, but I'm assuming that procedures were followed.
Yeah, this is entirely preventable, and I hate to see us either make claims against insurance and pay the deductible for things that we can clearly prevent by following procedure. And the next item I had was on item Q, the fiscal year 24 voluntary contributions. And there was like, I seen where we pegged it against three items, but in the sections below, there was like six different things. So how did we choose the three that it went against? And is, you know, what's the rationale, logic behind the three that we chose and the amounts?
There are seven departments where donations can be made, and when the donations are made, they're made to specific departments, and that's how we determine where those three items are going.
So did they request it?
When they make a voluntary contribution, there's a checkbox, what do you want to contribute to? And those, the summation of these, and I don't know if these are onesie twosies or if these are one lump sum contributions, but anyone that checked a box, those dollar amounts, because someone checked a box specifically for it.
And this is voluntary contributions from staff or from citizens?
Citizens.
Okay.
Yep. $80,000 to the school, that's impressive.
I wasn't
that. That was from the
estate. That was from the EMS stuff.
Yeah.
That's the EMS stuff when they bought the equipment.
And how much was that again, do you remember?
$80,000 would be my guess.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I was thinking it was a little less than that. Okay.
It was
$80,000. Yeah. I mean, being new, I've seen that. I couldn't understand how you got those numbers. I just wanted to. Being new, I mean, I've never seen this before. I'm sure Mr. Goad hasn't. And it was just something, where did we come up with this? But it's good to know.
Yeah, the voluntary contributions, we have a program for that. We have a policy for that. And then on certain forms, I think even, I don't know exactly, I don't remember 100% where it is.
But I think even on your taxes, too, are certain things where if you send in payments, there's check boxes if you want to pay extra to something, or if you have overages, or if you just want to contribute to something, there's a specific check box from what you want to contribute to.
And if nobody checks a box, then I'm guessing we would divide that amongst the all seven.
It would go it goes to general fund.
General fund?
Yeah. I would have to look back at the policy, but I believe it goes back to general fund is what my recollection is.
What's the average amount that we collect do that every year?
This year is going to be...
Off the top of my head.
I mean, the 80,000 definitely skews our average, but I would, if I had to imagine, we probably don't get more than $5,000 to $10,000 in a year.
So, is that specific to the schools?
No, just in general.
I think it's the same in general, yeah. Okay.
I was going to say, and this would be, you know, emergency services. Somebody got taken to the hospital and they think they saved somebody's life, so they might have just said, hey, divide this, give us the emergency services.
Yeah. I think also some of the donations that Pavanna Rescue Squad now are coming to the county.
Because it's no longer.
Yeah. Some people just keep saying that same check, so that's going to the county now.
I'm surprised more people aren't making voluntary donations to the schools. But anyway, any more questions or items anybody wants to pull?
I move we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hogg, second by Mr. Goode. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Board votes aye. 5-0. We'll move on to unfinished business. Solar Ordinance Review Committee update. Mr. Whitten.
I guess, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So I gave a similar presentation to the Planning Commission. So this one, so Mr. Goode's already heard this one, so he can go take another bath break.
I'm all right for right now, dude. Thank you.
It's a matter of time.
Could have used that as a heads up on when to go earlier.
So the board did approve the creation of the committee on April 3rd for this year, and the board appointed Mr. Hodge and Mr. O'Brien to the committee. And on April 9th, the Planning Commission appointed Ms. Kilpatrick and Ms. Johnson Morgan to the committee. So, as you remember, at the board's meeting on March 6th, the board approved the resolution to amend the county code to remove utility-scale solar as a use allowed, a special use permit in A1. And so the committee had the task of considering the removal of the use, and the Planning Commission has to hold a public hearing by June 20th regarding the removal of the use from the A1 district. And also at that same meeting on March 6th, the board approved the resolution of intention to enact Section 22-17-21 to add supplemental regulations for small-scale, minor-scale, and utility-scale solar generation facilities. And so the committee is going to consider those supplemental regulations at a future committee meeting. The committee met twice, approximately for about an hour and a half each time, and primarily the committee discussed the zoning district itself rather than the supplemental. The committee discussed supplemental regulations tangentially as well. So the Planning Commission has to hold a public hearing by September 20th to consider the supplemental regulations. So the options the committee discussed were creating a new zoning district that authorizes utility-scale solar facilities and minor-scale solar facilities by special use permit. And they also discussed creating a zoning overlay district that authorized utility-scale solar facilities and minor-scale solar facilities by special use permit. So they kind of discussed the pros and cons, the rezoning, pros of creating a new zoning district. The rezoning would be required, which would allow for voluntary proffers, so you could limit certain uses in that zoning district. And the special use permit would still be required, which would allow conditions. And then they discussed basically certain A1 by right uses and uses by special use permit could still be allowed. The negative would be you could have the argument of spot zoning. But I did look into the case law a little bit, and illegal spot zoning is only deemed to exist where the court can find there's no public benefit, and it's only to serve a private interest. So there hasn't been too many successful cases over the years to claim, you know, basically by what the court found there was spot zoning. So as long as there's a public benefit, that even if you have, you know, the same zoning here and then 3 miles, you know, adjacent, you have the same zoning, it's hard to establish spot zoning. So the intent of the ordinance for this new zoning district would be to have the zone basically along the transmission lines. So we talked about a mile and a half within the transmission lines, we would have that in the purpose statement for the ordinance. So basically, that would be the intent of this new zoning district. So then we talked about the pros and cons of the overlay district. This would be designated areas on either side of the high voltage transmission lines, and a special use permit would be required, which would allow conditions for these utility scale solar facilities. And then also you would still have the underlying zoning district by right uses and uses by special use permit. And the negatives would be there's no rezoning required, so there wouldn't be any voluntary proffers. It'd also be hard to contain the solar project completely within the overlay district. What that would mean is you might have a large portion of the project outside the overlay, or you may have to constantly change the boundaries of the overlay district depending on the size of the solar facility. So the recommendation of the Planning Commission was, after hearing the committee report, was to advertise a public hearing on June 11th to remove utility scale solar from the A1 zoning district. And the Planning Commission also recommended advertising a new zoning district with supplemental regulations. They didn't set a time for when that advertisement would be, but basically the public hearing has to be held before September 20th. So it'd be sometime this summer after the committee is able to meet a few times, more times, to discuss the supplemental regulations and what those would look like. So I did provide to the committee and to the Planning Commission a couple examples. So Dinwiddie County recently enacted a solar energy district, and actually on May 21st, they had their first public hearing or rezoning and CUP for a solar facility called Lily Pond. I think it's like an 80 megawatt Energex facility. So I went over supplemental regulations that they had established, basically establishing the meetings of staff, discussing the site plan, the components of the facility, insurance when they're building it, the visual impact, the signage, the noise, and also they went into great, this pretty long ordinance, so they went into great depth regarding the setbacks, the height, the buffer, inspections, decommissioning bonds. It was interesting, they actually waived substantial accord determinations as part of this ordinance. So right now, the Planning Commission here has to do the substantial accord analysis under 15.2.232. Then they also discussed siting agreements. So the other option that we discussed was what Surrey recently did earlier this year, and that's south of the James River. So basically, they created our Emerging Technologies District, which basically allows data centers, energy storage facilities, so battery storage, and renewable energy generation facilities by right. And they allowed other by right and conditional use permit uses. But what was interesting is they had a minimum size of 500 acres for the parcel to be zoned to this district, and a maximum height of 75 feet. And they also went into supplemental regulations discussing the meeting of staff, application requirements, submitting the preliminary and final plans. And what was interesting is their energy generating facilities, solar facilities, had to produce energy for on-site consumption. So they couldn't be used to support uses outside the district. So I was reading an article earlier today, basically for these data centers, you can't really put the solar panels on the roofs because that's where all the cooling facilities are. So really, they in Surrey County imagine the solar fields being next to the data centers rather than on top of them. So those are the two ordinances we discussed. And I think once the committee meets more, we can come back with their recommendations. But so with regarding the public hearing on June 11th, if the Planning Commission recommends approval, that would come back to the board most likely at the July meeting. We have one meeting in July, which is July 3rd.
I'll just add, Mr. Witt did a good job making materials to the members of the commission and also guiding the conversation. I think we all had very robust and open conversations and a lot of back and forth. The presentation covers pretty much everything that occurred from that standpoint. And the recommendation was left open in terms of the Emerging Technologies District as an option. There was a little bit of debate as to whether that should be proposed now or not. But we left that to the Planning Commission to decide, and of course up to the board from that standpoint. Just out of note of interest on this, the federal, this just came in I think today, but basically the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission voted 2-1 on Monday to modernize the nation's long-distance high-power transmissions policies geared to meeting the Biden administration's decarbonization goals and to harden the grid to withstand extreme weather that could create havoc on local real economies, on local economies. The changes have multiple ramifications to a backstop authority or ability to build transmission when progress slows over the next decade. It will lead to considerably more renewable energy and noticeably less coal-fired. For both reasons, litigation will abound, and although the regulatory commissioners consider that before approving the new policies. So, you know, the you're seeing, again, from the federal and state level, the push to do this in order to meet the demands that they're foreseeing due to data centers and due to AI is a big part of it. And also due to the electric vehicles and the demands on the grid that they're bringing from that standpoint. So interesting that you're seeing continued momentum coming from other levels.
And I will tell you, we had our board of directors meeting last week. I was going to talk about this later, but I'll just talk about it now. This was one of the huge conversations that we had for a while. And one of the things is basically, it's like I talked about when we talked about solar stuff before. They're basically giving us a year to come up with regulations on how much we want, where we want, things of that nature. And they really, as a group, could not believe that it was not passed on to the SCC. What they talked about, and we thought, might have an opportunity. They could not believe that it was not passed in Richmond to do that. But they were almost like, okay, we better come up with something that I guess gives ground both ways, because this is one of those things that if not, it's next year, it won't be a maybe. That was kind of the general thinking. That conversation.
That was VACA, and VACA?
The VACA board of directors, yes. We got together last week, or 2 weeks ago. So I just wanted to pass that on.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of discussion among the committee as well, too, about, you know, proposed regulation and what might happen from that standpoint.
And how do we do it? You know?
One of the people that VACO's expert on this is Joe Lurch. So I asked him about, can we get anything of this in writing? They said no, but if you want to have some people want to talk to Joe Lurch, that's the guy to talk to him. He's one of the VACO guys.
Personally, so my concerns with creating what, an S district?
Correct.
Yeah.
Is that the concerns of what could happen and what we don't know are not changed. It just, we now have those concerns scrunched into one area. And, you know, like land values, of course it reduces land values. And if you have a house or a farm beside it, it's gonna reduce the value of your land. To the contrary, somebody that is already involved in a deal to try to do it, or was hoping to do a deal in the Fork Union District or the Cunningham District. I'm just not sure how we say, we're not giving you that same opportunity. We're going to create a district over here for that. Now, these people can sell their land for more. And on the flip side, we're not going to impact these neighbors, but we're going to impact these neighbors.
Yeah, there was I don't mean to monopolize, Mr. Hodge, if you want to add, but, you know, again, there was some discussion around all of that, but ultimately, you know, the kind of thinking is that you're within anywhere from 1 to 1.5 miles of major transmission lines, and that is where the projects would go by default anyhow. So, you know, that idea that you're denying maybe somebody who doesn't live in that area, the practical reality is that they probably wouldn't be a first choice for a project like that.
But don't worry, we already have them in Fork Union, and well, both are in Fork Union District. Being
as long as you're near a transmission, a major transmission line, that's the plus, right? So, because, you know, when you're producing energy, the amount of loss that occurs
over
due to the size of transmission lines over distance is significant.
And you'd have to put, if you went aerial, you'd have to put high transmission lines into the nearest point if you're away from it, or bury it, which is even more expensive. So we're not saying you can't, but by the same token, a landowner in the middle of the Cunningham District can't be like, I don't know why you guys are denying me building a food line store here. There's not a food line's not wanting to build there. The energy companies aren't going to want to go away from the high power lines. So what we were trying to look at is, if we put up a we're closed sign, the state will turn around and they'll put it, they'll tell us where it's going to go. So how do we find that compromise of finding the best way to do it for Fluvanna with sensible regulation so that these look good and they serve the best interest of the community, and it's a matter of striking that balance. But you know, if a landowner wants to go pitch to an energy company and he lives 8 miles from a power line, knock yourself out. But I can't see where you get takers.
And the other component to keep in mind is that the first part of the committee's task was to basically decide whether or not we should look at putting it just in I-1 or moving it to a different location. Or keeping it in A1 or some other alternative. So that was the first task. You know, once that's done, and we had a deadline under which we had to do that, so we were only able to meet twice to have the discussion.
Yes.
Of course, the first meeting is kind of a open discussion, get mm-hmm. to, you know, do a little bit of thoughts about it so that everyone could go back and research. But we basically had to make the recommendation by the second meeting. So due to that compressed timeline, there wasn't a lot, and I'm not saying that we need another meeting necessarily, but I'm just saying that did kind of compress the time frame. Now that that's done, it's going to the Planning Commission, the board will then consider it. The committee's going to be needing to review different types of ordinances, which address some of the concerns that you mentioned in the past.
And it did come up. You know, it would be a by right use in I-1. And do you want a parcel of agriculture rezoned to I-1? And then the solar company pulls out when you put a junkyard or a factory or a cement plant. And by having this S solar S district with sub rights to do agriculture, it allows you, if you want to put sheep under the panel and do some agriculture related in addition to that, you can do that. But it also doesn't give you that by right industrial use in a rural agricultural area. And I think that's where we struck the balance. And the question was brought up, so do we or do we not allow it in A1? That was the core question. And my statement, and I said these exact words to the committee, do you really want to forward it back to the board who make it pretty clear in remanding it down to a committee and remanding it to the Planning Commission that the intent was not to have it in A1? So we had to find another solution, and it's either I-1 or create the S district, and the S district with the rezoning still will come before the Planning Commission and the board. So it's not a rubber stamp guarantee that's going to happen, but it's also not a solid denial either. It leaves room to maneuver and see what works best for the residents and the landowners of Fluvanna County.
The other advantage, too, that wasn't mentioned is that the Commissioner of Revenue could choose to value that land differently as well, too, generating higher tax revenues as well. Outside of the site improvements.
It is so simple. Did we talk about a maximum number of acres, like percentages?
We didn't want to digress, and that would be something we would address in the ordinance, the rules part.
Right.
That's something I
want to make sure that we look at.
Yes.
There's a maximum number of acres allowable in solar.
Yeah, and I would say, it, to all extents possible, equitable distribution of that acreage, because, I mean, call it what you want. I mean, I don't have, I know y'all have seen map of transition lines at those meetings, but if I were to just take a guess as to where most of those transmission lines were, those pieces of land that would want to get rezoned to this new S, it would probably be right there in my district where a lot of these utility scale solar farms are being proposed. So, for me, and voicing some of the concerns of the folks in that part of the county that I represent, that a lot of those utility scale projects are being proposed, I mean, on the one hand, you feel this, if you're opposed to it, you feel this sort of momentum that, you know, hey, we're looking at doing away with this in the A1, but on the other hand, it's like, you're just kind of opening the door on the back end, you know, and if the, you know, Mr. Fairchild said it before, and I think I'm mostly with him on this, if the ban on A1 was just to, is to take some pressure off while we continue to learn more and see how this grows and develops and maybe what other things come along. When you open the door on the other end, it really makes the initial thing there irrelevant, honestly, because, yeah, and this came up at the Planning Commission. I mean, those folks that have special use permit applications submitted, there would have to technically turn around and submit a rezoning application, but you know they're going to do that, and, I mean, that's where most of those projects are going to be proposed anyway. So getting back to Mr. Sheridan's point, I mean, we could talk about a total acreage, but if all of that is condensed in one area that's already sheltered a majority of the energy burden in this community, I would have significant concerns with that.
The way, you'd have to correct me because you did the map, Mr. Hodge, better than, but I mean, certainly Fort Union, Cunningham, and I think parts of Columbia.
Columbia has Crossroads, a huge line.
The problem is,
components to it, so.
The problem is that 75% of the county's in our two districts, so you'd be equal. There's no way he's getting equal to his house.
Not happening.
Unless they're putting it in the golf course. I mean, I'm not being argumentative, but that's going to be the problem is we're 70% of the counties in our two districts.
Yeah. Fort Union, Columbia.
I understand that.
I'm not a fan of it.
So what some localities have done is you have to be, you know, 1 mile away from another solar facility or half mile away, so you kind of separate them. I've seen some localities that
there were some even as high as 5 miles. No other solar Correct. Facility within 5 miles. 5 mile radius around it, and it becomes an exclusion zone.
So if it's almost all going to go to where there's already transmission lines, and we create these districts, but they're where the transmission lines are, then we've really not accomplished much that I can see, because this district, because it's where the transmission lines are, it was going to go there anyway. And so we've said we're going to allow this to happen, the mass of it to come there. It wasn't going to come in the rest of the A1 anyway. And that is A1 that you're now talking about S. It is currently A1. So we did switch A1. We did allow it in A1.
So
if we do,
again, there was, you know, discussion back and forth on that. I mean, you know, the I-1, if you looked at just what is available for I-1 currently, there's not there. The idea of spot zoning was kind of, I don't want to say put words in your mouth, but would be difficult to enforce from that standpoint. So we put ourselves in a situation where, while we may think that, while certain members of the board may think that they were accomplishing basically a situation where it was going to be limited just to I-1, there was nothing preventing somebody from applying for I-1 inside the district. Inside any of the district from that standpoint. The ability to then put in S1 and then have, you know, an area that we're controlling from that standpoint, an area that we can tax a little bit differently and not have to be concerned about what the use might be for that land once it's rezoned, if it's I-1, was kind of the overall thinking, you know, from that standpoint. I mean, I certainly argued quite a bit about why are we even doing any of this, you know? So, I mean, why are we not just keeping it in A1 with special use permit? And that was a big part of the discussion as well, too, which was, you know, the ability to maintain that special use permit to have a little bit more control and to make sure that the provider was meeting those needs, or otherwise we could take away the special use permit. So that gave us more leverage over any of the folks that were putting in plants that weren't being well-maintained and or weren't matching the ordinances that we had in place. And as Mr. Whitten pointed out, it's not following county ordinance is a criminal violation.
Not following the zoning ordinance.
Yeah.
We definitely do not want A1 parcels being rezoned I-1. And we don't want the state telling us, because if we don't change this and they tell us we have to put it in, guess what's going to happen? They're going to put in rezoning requests, and that's something we do not want.
Well, couldn't you have the S in place in case, in the event that that happens?
Yeah,
I mean, we could institute those, that district if that was to happen with the state?
Well, again, you know, this is a committee's task. We're not voting on this right now. We're discussing it. It's gone to the Planning Commission. There will be a public hearing. So, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, we've now done, you know, our portion of what was first tasked to us. We will be doing the next portion, which is, you know, to review the ordinances and that, and what makes sense as far as those goes. Those go, and they're both going to go to the Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors to vote on it. But, you know, it was a good discussion. I think, you know, it was a good compromise overall from that standpoint. So
I appreciate the work that you all have done, and so on. I mean, with no disrespect, there's clearly a lot of thoughts going into it. I'll just wrap my side over saying I'm not sure we've really created much different than where we're at. And the people in that district already that are on those lines are already as concerned as they are, and now we're saying that's gonna become the zone.
I think you can pretty much anticipate that regulation will be put upon us that is gonna require a minimum use of land without complaint. So to the degree that we have systems in place and put that where we would prefer to see it, the better off we are. After that 4% of land is utilized, at that point in time, we'll probably have more discretion. You know, and you know, there's still an awful lot that's happening. Virginia Tech is doing a program where they're reviewing, and this was just an article the other day, but Virginia Tech's doing a program where they're looking at how to do agrivoltaics and you know how that can be better used. So the growth of agrivoltaics is going to continue to be significant from that standpoint, which helps to address folks' concerns regarding the degradation of the land. And also, you know, maintains the farming aspect that many people would want to see happening from that land. So,
and I can rebut because you reminded me that we're not making a vote tonight. No. So.
We're having a lot of good conversation right now. And I will just add, when I talk about percentage of land, I looked it up. 2% is 3,700, 3% is 5,500, 4% is 7,400 acres.
Out of a total of 80,000.
186,000 or something.
So, what is our next move on this?
So, Planning Commission will have a public hearing June 11th. If they recommend approval or denial, it would come back to the board July 3rd. If they defer it, obviously that would extend it out. So, because we only had the one meeting in July, the public hearing would be July 3rd on the removing utility scale solar from the A1. And then the supplemental regulations that will come back to the board in, you know, September, October timeframe, most likely.
There was a lot of discussion during those meetings. Do you do them both hand in hand, create the S1 or whatever, and remove the A1 at the same time? But where the kind of the commission or the group ended on was let's move forward and remove A1 first from the ordinance, and then make a recommendation for the new zone.
That would get more time for discussion. Yeah, otherwise, we would rush the committee to.
Yeah. I do apologize. I think you have the administration.
Oh, that's fine.
And what I suggested too was that, you know, if that vote does happen, you know, where we vote to ban an A1, I suggested, you know, because I mean, you guys have spent a lot of time on this, and I appreciate that. But if you didn't have enough folks willing to say, we want to turn around and then consider this. So my suggestion at the planning, when we were discussing this on the Planning Commission was, and I don't know if this is a possibility or the legality of it, but to basically have a follow-up resolution that says, we would like to direct the Planning Commission to continue looking at, you know, either whether it's S1 or this emerging technologies, it seems like it would be leaning S1 based on the you know, thoughts of the committee itself. But if you didn't have three board members willing to say, right now we would like to continue looking at this, I mean, that was just my thought. So, kind of like a nod of like, hey, yeah, continue looking at this, or you know, because I would hate to see work put in with it if ultimately that wouldn't have the support that it needs. And I'm not saying it does or it doesn't by any stretch of the means. So, that was just a thought that I threw out there as well with that conversation. So.
I don't know. What is the? I mean, once a directive has been made.
Well, I mean, the directive was made to the Planning Commission to come back with supplemental regulations. So the board would have to pass a new motion withdrawing that directive.
Okay.
I mean, that was the directive that like we should hold a public hearing on supplemental regulations by September 20th.
Okay.
So, I mean, I guess theoretically you could do a motion to reconsider that and say we no longer want that resolution, but right now that's what the Planning Commission, their duty is to have a public hearing by September 20th.
I would have thought those supplemental regulations, ignoring everything else, you want something in place to say what the buffers look like, how close you can get to streams, how close you want them together. If you think it's going to burden one community, then create, like a lot of the counties have, that you can have another solar facility within 5 miles. So you create an exclusion zone around it. Then they're not building 30 of them in a very small area. It forces them to move down the transmission line. So, I mean, not passing the regulations, you'll end up with instances like we have at the Palmer Solar Farm, where they're not mowing it, it's not maintained, there's broken panels, the fire department gets called out all the time. So those regulations, if you don't do anything else, I implore you to consider putting those in place. That's important. And where we put it is a separate conversation.
So again, no action by the board. Like I said, Mr. Witt just wanted to provide just kind of a recap of, you know, what was the same, you know, presentation given to the Planning Commission and kind of, you know, where things are at this point.
All right, moving on to item 12, new business. Anybody have anything?
I would be remiss if we didn't at least acknowledge Mr. Schoenster's comments at the beginning. Just, you know, appreciate you speaking out. And I think, you know, he had some specific questions that deserve to be addressed. And if folks, and as I say that, I'll pull the microphone to my face to make sure that I'm being heard. And I when you said unintelligible, I assume you meant you couldn't hear, not that. That's what I thought you meant. So my recollection of the conversation of that meeting was, and again, this is just my recollection, so fill in gaps, correct me where you think I may or may not be wrong, was that we did have an extensive conversation about the salary study. Mr. Kelly expressed his, you know, feel that we really needed to include that in this budget. There were some other representatives from the school that said that they felt like it could be...
point of clarification, not the salary study.
Population study. Sorry, there was a lot of salary population. Yes. Population study, my apologies, thank you. But there were some folks at the school that said there was some, I don't want to say debate, but sort of not clear on a consensus on whether it was needed right this second or whether it could wait until carryover. And I think if I recall, I specifically asked someone whether or not if this would be something that they would prioritize as a funding thing in carryover, and it was indicated to us that it would be. So that is my recollection of the conversation. I don't know if anybody else has anything to throw in on that.
I mean, I brought it up when we were discussing the leftover money that we ended up putting in general fund. I made the suggestion, why don't we use some of that and just do it? And then that opened the discussion, is it a Board of Supervisors thing to do? Mm-hmm. Or was it a school board thing to do? And there seemed to be not any clarity, and that kind of died on the floor, which then it deferred back to, do we want them to use carryover?
Well, I think the concern, I don't want to say the concern, maybe we can get an update on the expected carryover, but due to the way the budget season, the way the funding season was going for the schools, that carryover might be very minimal, if any, I don't know, but you know, I don't have the latest update.
Could James come up and address us, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Hey, folks. Good evening. So as it relates to carryover, I mean, I think I heard Dr. Gritz today, this morning at a meeting, indicate that we could be lucky if we have 150 left to give back to you guys. Normally it's $500,000, $1 million, and we're here asking for carryover funds to invest in things because we're able to manage that budget. What's happened this year is that the state has just pulled our funding out from under us continuously and with regularity to the point where, like, we're managing down to, like, bare bones. And if it's not for not Brenda Gillum and her team, we'd be in some real trouble. And so that's why we continue to manage down there. I will note that we did include, the board has, the the school board, and I want to be careful about when I speak as an individual and when I speak as a school board member, it's particularly important, and I try to make that as clear as possible. The board did speak as a majority and ask it to be included in carryover last year. That was not funded, but we were given money for bathrooms and other things, and I really appreciate that. When it came back up to be included for consideration in the school budget this year, there was articulation around why would we put something in that will like increase our recurring revenue line. So isn't this more appropriate for something like a carryover, or it's not big enough for a CIP, so where does it belong? So there was more conversation around where it fits. And this year, to be honest, we're gonna give you back 150 is my best guess. And Brenda's really conservative, and so maybe it'll be a little bit more and we'll be lucky. But if we ask you for it in November, then we can't use it until whenever it comes back. And at this point, to be honest, at some point that neighborhood's gonna open up, and I don't know if we're gonna, you know, we're tracking 290 kids in kindergarten or something year over year. At some point we're gonna have 320 or something show up. And regardless of whether or not we have a study, I don't know where they're going. And so I'm probably coming back to you if I'm still on this board when all of that happens to ask you for money for trailers, because we're just not paying attention to where the numbers are. And we can shift grades all day long, but there are some, you know, some structural issues with putting little kids in buildings where urinals are for like higher up. And you know, I'm not sure that anybody in this county wants seventh graders in a high school where we have the most capacity. And so the further, you know, the sooner we get ahead of this, the more opportunity we have to figure out where to put kids in the existing buildings, whether or not they'll fit, and what we're going to do to the extent that we have, you know, 320, 330 kindergartners or what have you. And I can't make that estimation because I don't know what types of families are going to ultimately move into these new developments. And that's what that 30,000 does, is get somebody who's an expert to tell us how many kindergartners or second graders we can expect based on the type of housing.
So the schools will know their carryover number or have that by November? It wouldn't be August or September?
No, we have to go through an audit process. And so we don't really know anything. We ask for carryover funds. We talk about it in October. We have to act on it in November so you guys can act on it in November. And then it takes time to release it back. To be honest, we're 5 years late on this, and I hold some responsibility for that, as does anyone who has touched this board or that board. Like, as we allow development by right, which is by right fundamentally, we are increasing the demand for the public services. And at this point, I'm not making evaluative judgment, and I've told you when I'm speaking for a board and when I'm speaking as an individual, I will say that, like, as an individual, I'm not passing evaluative judgment on whether or not those homes should or shouldn't exist. I'm just saying that as more homes exist, we're just going to have increased need.
Well, I keep in mind that, you know, any planning for a new facility for the school system, you know, what was the domino plan way back in the day, you know, those plans typically take not just years, but decades. So, you know, to that degree, you know, the planning board, the school board, getting the information they need to plan effectively is important. I'm not so certain that, you know, waiting until November is a bad idea myself, personally. The question, you know, might come up is they come in November and they have a different priority. I don't think that changes the fact that this should still be a priority if the board looks at it from that standpoint. And the reason I say November simply being because we may have a sense of what the demographics are going to look like for people coming in.
People start moving in.
Yeah.
So, well,
I mean, but I think you argued against that.
I didn't make an argument either way as it relates to, like, do we need to do it right now? I made the statement that we need to do it 5 years ago. I think Pete echoes that when he's here. The difference in a couple of months isn't significant. I'm hopeful that this board, the school board, will ask for it in carryover. There have been years where the board has refused to ask for any carryover. I know that I was able to get three of us to do it last year, and I'm going to fight hard to try again this year to the extent that it's not commissioned in advance of that. And so I'm optimistic that come November I'll be begging for that 30 grand again. And if not, I'll be up here as an individual asking you, not as the voice of the board, but as an independent citizen asking you to make that investment for us.
From, do you mean from a carryover request or from like contingency or something?
However you can do it is great, to the extent that I have authority from, or whatever, that there's a majority of the board who has spoken in unison to say, this, please use carryover money for this, then that's a little easier to articulate. But
Mr. Bryant, were you suggesting November timeline because
that's
of
my recommendation.
Because of when, because of the development, more understanding of what's going in there and the demographics and the ages?
When they came in here and talked about it, they used their experts, and I think it was 0.6 students or 0.5 students per dwelling. So it was the number that they used towards us, if I remember correctly. And so the thing that we need to remember, and the thing that I think kind of slipped, got by us here, the state, I spoke with the chairman before I came over here, the state shorted Fluvanna County $900,000 this year or somewhere in that effect. And, you know, if you talk to your Congress delegate, if you talk to your state senator, please just bring up the JLARC study that they paid for, that they did, that said, oh, by the way, you're now $3.5 billion behind per year in funding of education. And so it,
what study was this?
JLARC.
J-L-A-R-C.
Don't ask me what it stands for, but they brought that up. It's J-L-A-R-C. And that was a study that they paid for, that they had done, that said that the state is $3.5 billion per year behind where they should be. That's why when you take Northern Virginia out of the equation and you compare public school salaries across the country, the state of Virginia is 49th. Because Northern Virginia, those numbers get skewed when you compare with Northern, when you don't take Northern Virginia out, because they get a cost of competing allowance to compete against Maryland so that they don't lose all their teachers. And that now comes down as far south, I believe, as Spotsylvania County.
JLARC is the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission.
There you go.
I think.
But their JLARC study said that they were $3.5 billion behind. So if we have a chance to talk to somebody at the state level, please remind them. You don't have a surplus till your debts are paid.
That's my wife mentioned it this morning, but you know, it was on, I think Sean Tubbs or whatever was doing a review and basically said that we're Virginia pay scale for teachers right now, just to get to the median in the states, would require a 12% increase. And that's on, and I was, that came
when,
in the conversation.
When you use Northern Virginia, we rank it, I think it's 29th. When you take Northern Virginia out of the equation, we go from 29th to 49th. And that's 13 counties versus the other 77. So it's not a comparison.
So population study, my understanding was that there didn't seem to be huge sense of urgency from schools that it had to be done right this second, but that once carryover season came around, that would be, if they were going to ask for something, that would be okay. You know, I want to say, it seemed like there was a nod that, hey, this is a big priority for us. Maybe doesn't need to happen right now, line item type thing, but come carryover season, this might be one of the first things that we're asking for. Was my understanding, so.
A meeting in the middle. Meaning not pressuring to get it now, while at the same time,
it's something that we can look at down the road. And 30,000 is not a huge number.
And if I recall, with the Pinnacle Group, when I recall asking the Pinnacle Group, how long do they think it would take for the apartments to fill up? And they said probably less than a year. Mm-hmm. Just to put that in perspective. So if we pass this in November and the study's ordered at the beginning of the year, there's a good chance that there's going to be a very good data point for the type of residents that are going to be in the apartments. That doesn't include the townhomes or the single-family homes there, but
correct.
Gives you some sense of what's going to happen.
I do believe that Mr. Park, when they gave us numbers, they used the standard state number, which was somewhere in the range of 0.6. And I was like, how do you have 0.6? Or 0.5.
Single people.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's going to be a lot of single bedroom apartments.
Six kids in 10 households.
Are we, what happened when they asked for the population study in Carryover last year? Remind me.
We funded the bathrooms.
We funded the bathrooms, which used up most of it. The bathrooms used up the vast majority of it.
Well, I think their total, amount left from fund balance or from what was left at the end of the year, I think it was $530,000, and I think they requested.
We gave them over $400,000.
Well, I think we gave them
$483,000.
Yeah, I think they requested the $530,000. $30,000 for this population study, and then a little under $499 and something for the bathroom study.
I'll say Mr. O'Brien makes a good point about having a good data point in November, and I think you talked with your board and made a request at that time that, you know, we would have probably seems a decent conversation about considering that. I don't want to speak for everybody else, but I know I would want to have a conversation about looking at that, because it maximizes the results we're getting with the money we're spending if we do it then. So I agree with Tony on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we answer all of Mr. Chester's questions?
All right.
Yep.
All right.
Any more new business?
I had one thing. I'm not sure, one more thing written down. I'm not sure if this would need to wait until we have a VDOT presentation, but there's a, you know, the tire warehouse in Fort Union. Apparently, the entrance to that is a VDOT right of way there. And within the last year, I think it's been the BSI moved out and the wholesale tire moved in. And there's a lot of a lot more coming in and out than it was when Archie was in there. So and this is from Chips on Elliott, is a friend of mine. It's coming from his dad, who owns the warehouse. VDOT owns the right of way. It has been maintained. It has not been maintained to its full capacity, such that it's been diminished in scope. Given our increase in business and traffic, we'd like to see them that it's maintained to the fullest extent. We employ 17 plus folks and have a lot of commercial and industrial traffic and need the space maintained. So that I can connect you with them if we need to, or connect them with someone if VDOT, if necessary.
And I'll tell you, Scott Burton with VDOT, he will be here at our next meeting on June 5th.
Okay.
And again, you know, so we're going to, I know there's lots of questions about previous speed studies. I know there's lots of discussions about the intersection down at Lake Monticello Road,
yes,
and South Boston Road. So I was going to try and give Scott Thornton a laundry list of things to be ready to.
Just a little heads up, and I'm sorry I aggravate myself by even bringing it up, but if I don't, I will be remiss. I'm not sure if anybody else got an email, but I got an email from a couple of residents on Dalby Creek Road about changing speed limit from 45 to 35. Yeah, it is definitely not a 45 road. I drive it a lot, the kids in the car.
So I can tell you, So statutory speed limits for secondary roads is 55. So as was discussed, for it to go from 55 down to 45, there either must have been some residential reasons or some line of sight reasons or something like that.
All of the above.
Or there could have been accidents or something like that.
It's all of the above. Yeah. It's had a lot of houses that have been popped up on it. That's why the residents are saying, can we look at changing it? It's a 2 mile long road.
What I will say is, after speaking with VDOT, really for something to go down to 35, it would require, I don't remember what the metric was, but you almost have to have a majority of the houses within 100 feet of the roadway for it to be considered 35 a residential area. And doing a quick look from GIS doesn't appear to be that. And so it was discussed that.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
Can I pass the gavel? I've got an emergency. I've got to step in front of what's going on.
Yep. And so
the thought was that the road, if the county wanted to invest in a speed study, looking at some of the initial metrics, the road probably wouldn't qualify. And oh, by the way, if you do a speed study and it's determined that things have changed, the speed limit could go back up to 55 if there's things that have changed.
Somebody ought to be smacked if they do.
I'm just telling you. So are you saying that a look into it could have the opposite effect?
It could.
Yeah, if it won't.
These are good questions for the next one.
The longest stream.
Yeah, I reach out to Scott Thornton today on this. He was going to look back at the previous speed studies or the studies or whatever it took to put the speed in front of
him. Okay, so you were brought that. Okay. So, I didn't know if anybody else got those or not, but yeah. I just wanted to bring
that up. I have one thing along the same line. Yeah. Just one favor to ask of this board, and if Scott could do it, I mentioned that section between Martin Kings and the county line. Yeah. So it goes down and up a rise. I went out there again to look, and the properties on the north side of the road isn't a problem. What I chose to do is not realize, and I turned in the property at the left just past the county line, and when I got turned around in that driveway and pulled out, I realized there was only 20 feet to the crest of the hill, so I didn't know what was coming over that crest at 55. So literally, when I made the decision to pull out, I had to push it to the floor. I don't know how that got VDOT connection approval, because that's definitely less than 100-foot sight line, should not have been approved, and it's only a matter of time before we have a very serious, imagine a car pulling out and another car hitting it in the side at 55. So if people are curious, go that way and turn right before the crest of the hill on the driveway and do a turn and try to pull back out on the road and tell me what you think.
That's past the county line sign?
Yes.
But Albemarle. Issue.
It is.
I hate to say it that way.
But VDOT controls that whole section.
I understand. Yeah. But I can tell you right now, pulling on Martin Kings,
yeah,
that ain't no fun. All right. Yeah. Any further business? If not, are you doing the...
No, second round of public.
Oh, shoot. Yep, I got it off my track. Train of thought. I'll now second round of public comment. Anyone wish to address the board, please approach your microphone. Keep your comments 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is anyone wish to speak at this time?
Good evening. James Jones, sir. 843 Jefferson Drive. I just wanted to thank y'all for taking up that conversation. It really does mean a lot that you're responsive, and I did have a lot of questions clarified. I've come up here a couple of times and said that I want to reiterate or agree with Mr. O'Brien's rationale. So this time I'll say I don't, but thank you so much for coming up and having that conversation. And I hope that the population study is approved for the sake of the county or the schools, whether they ask for any carryover or not, because it's important that we have that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Jason Sweeney, 3456 James Madison. Two things. First, we're next door to that same the Discount Tire property, and we have that same issue. I drive out every morning. You get 1 second to look at people coming around that BP at 55. If they're going faster than 55 in the 55 zone, which they mostly do, you have to look twice. It's scary. They have to look at that again. And then about the solar thing, I just wanted to cheerlead a little bit for you guys again about thank you for taking it up. Thank you for thinking about it. I can hear you guys going through a lot of these things. I did want to say, you know, I hope we don't get too much into fatalism about assuming that we have to accept all the solar like the rest of the state. We don't. Like, part of this is like you guys, you know, we're the citizens. You guys represent us in our county. We love the county. Many of us don't want the county to turn into a giant industrial solar project. And, you know, I think, Mr. Goh, like, I'm in the Fork Union District. I actually live in a house that's going to be impacted by some of these projects that they're looking at down by the river. You know, we talk about 3%, 4%. If Fork Union is taking it, it's not 3 or 4% of the acreage of Fork Union. It might be a lot more than that. And we shouldn't have to bear that as citizens, not our county and not the districts within the county. Like that's the problem of this age, and that's why we've been coming and talking to y'all about it, is that we're at this clash moment where we have these giant industrial solar projects coming in, and there's just not infrastructure, like legal infrastructure and zoning infrastructure yet to account for it. And we're just little tiny citizens but we have these massive million, multi-million dollar companies that can lobby you guys, can lobby the state, they can advertise, they can do things that we just can't do as citizens, and we really rely on you guys to help protect us and the county, our county, your county. That's why we're here. These people, all these solar projects are not our county. So please, I really do ask you guys to please keep considering like the size of these projects, the density of these projects, and remember that you guys don't have to put up with it. As part of this whole process, you can come up with rules that restrict where and how they do these, how big they are, and protect our resources. You guys can make hardcore regulations about the wildlife and about our watersheds, and you should. And those things should limit these projects too, in addition to all the other things you guys are considering. Our county's worthy of the protection, so I look forward to continue talking to you. Thank you, guys.
Anyone else at this time? Seeing none, I'll now close second round of public comment. Now, Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, I move the Savannah County Board of Supervisors and enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A1 of the Code of Virginia as amended. For Section 2.2-3711A8 of the Code of Virginia as amended for the purpose of discussing legal matters. 1, Woodseed Settlement and Release Agreement, and 2, Mountain Hill Subdivision.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-0-1. We are now in closed session.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and 2, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were discussed or considered in the meeting.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. Roll call.
Hodge, aye.
Good.
Aye.
Y'all can say your name. Sheridan.
Aye.
O'Brien.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion made by O'Brien.
Sheridan. I was quicker.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody against?
Negative.
Chair votes
drive.
Chair votes
patterns.
Board votes aye. That's what Chris always says.